For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers around the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabre, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Their latest arrivals include from Arrow Video, the complete Gamera collection, and Beyond the Door, from Cauldron Films, Abracadabra, and American Rickshaw, and from Scream Factory, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. Whether you're looking for a definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com. That's DiabolikDVD.com. It's a little crazy out there right now, so Fangoria is offering a free 2-month digital membership to everyone. Go to Fangoria.com for more information and to make an account. Then pour over all the exclusive articles, interviews, and reviews on the site, as well as original video content and podcasts. You'll even have access to high-resolution scans for the first 15 issues and original run of Fangoria magazine and counting. Go to Fangoria.com now to start your free digital membership. And if you're looking to add to your social distancing watch list, Fangoria's latest movie, VFW, is now available to stream on demand, and Satanic Panic is streaming on Shudder right now. And don't forget, our good friends over at Fright Rags have the official Shockwaves t-shirt, both the classic design from Cavity Colors originally and the new design that has our faces on it that you can touch all you want from a very safe distance.
Good evening and welcome to Shockwaves number 186. I am your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me tonight from his, literally, it's like you're surrounded by DVDs, like you're broadcasting from a video
Blu-ray.
Store. Blu-ray, sorry. Rob Blues. It is Yes. Beautiful, though. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you. Wow. This is. I don't have a family or kids running around like you guys. I have this, which
I can send some over.
No, it's you keep the kids. I'll stay with the movies. I am drinking a beer like 2-3 of my co-hosts. Elric Kane definitely is drinking a beer.
You better not be drinking Heineken. I see a green bottle.
I'm drinking Heineken.
No!
And I was just listening to the Blue Velvet soundtrack, actually. So that's pretty funny. Yeah.
Fuck Heineken.
I got to tell you, Elric, like growing up, when I was a kid and growing up through high school, Pabst was what you drank if you were like dirt poor and 16. Any respectable beer drinker would never drink Pabst.
Yeah, they would if they're called podcasters. With our money, what we make, I'm drinking Pabst.
I have a PG Tips black tea and a diet ginger ale. So all right. I'm really lame. Ryan, what are you drinking tonight?
Oh, am I on the show? Hey. It's always a challenge getting through these intros. I am drinking lemon and ginger tea here in my home office.
The audience can't see, but you were like pensively looking out your window as the sun goes down.
That was my attention slowly diminishing as we talk about beers. I have a lovely view that I was just enjoying the sun's rays as they descend on the earth.
And by the way, and we have a special guest who apparently only joins us in times of crisis.
Yeah, Mallory.
Exactly a year ago today,
we
were driving from Chattanooga. We were trying to escape Chattanooga. And we had to drive
in a tornado. In tornado.
Nashville.
Yeah, thunderstorms. We did a night together in Nashville. It was crazy. We should have got tattoos. We did get barbecue.
You know, I was going to bring this up, but today I was like going over my homework for this episode, and I was like, isn't the last time I talked to the three of them when we were trapped in Chattanooga during this crazy snowstorm that had happened and screwed up all the air flights and
drive
to Chattanooga? I was like, I think they only call me in when like something really bad is going down.
We call Mallory.
There's a little
Mallory Ramirez here,
encased in glass, and it says Mallory O'Mara, and you smash it when something bad is happening.
Now, Well, hopefully, I mean, I'm hoping that Chattanooga happens sometimes. They just announced that because they had to cancel this year that they were going to do an online thing. So I'm really hoping we can get involved in that in some capacity.
So it is definitely canceled for the whole year? I thought it was just another delay.
It might just be a delay. I'm not too sure on that, but they are doing some type of online thing. They did like a beautiful, I'm hoping. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a digital version of it in some capacity that everyone, and I'm privy to a little bit of it, and it's going to be really cool. I think it's premature to talk about, but it will be really cool.
Make plans right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but they got something brewing.
How are you holding up, Mallory, since last year, trapped in Nashville?
I'm doing okay. I will say, we were talking before we started recording, as an introverted writer who works from home, I feel like the freelancers are going to inherit the earth because we're so used to all of this. I was like, stay inside for 2 months and watch horror movies and read. I was made for and eat out of cans. This is what I was training for my whole life.
Yeah. What is your physical distancing hobby?
I mean, I'm still honestly, what's sad is that my routine really hasn't changed, except I don't get to go to the gym. I mean, I write all day. I read a lot. I watch movies. I play World of Warcraft with my boyfriend. I hang out with my cats. This is the things I do normally, except I don't get to. I really, really, really miss going to the movies. That's the big thing that has changed. That's probably one of the first things I'm going to do when this all ends. Is I'm just going to go see any movie, just be in a movie theater.
Elric and I have talked about this, about how that's like the biggest thing is we miss just sitting in a theater. It's weird that is kind of one of the biggest things I miss, like going running, because I run a lot was like a big one, but I've replaced that with playing Animal Crossing. So
that's one of the, it's baking bread, playing Animal Crossing, or doing puzzles. That's like the three pathways to quarantine that everyone is taking.
Ryan, did you start playing Animal Crossing? Because I know your daughter's doing it. You got to try that.
I'm doing messed up puzzles. We finished the Beyond and we're on to Maniac, which has it's proven to be quite the challenge because generally you could begin with the borders and the border has taken us two nights so far because it's all black. Everything is black. Whoa. So we have no idea. We might abandon ship, but we'll see what happens.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. This looks really cool though. What company is making those?
Messed Up Puzzles.
Oh, very cool.
Oh, I thought you were joking when you said that. I didn't realize it was a brand name.
Yeah, Messed Up Puzzles has a license with Blue Underground, so they've been doing stuff like Pieces, The Beyond, Cannibal Holocaust, Silent Night, Deadly Night, Maniac, and then Necromantic 1 and 2. Yeah. So if you want to do puzzles of some corpses getting in on some sexy time, then these are the puzzles for you.
It's the gift that just keeps on giving.
I know.
Do you do with them when you're done? Are you the type that like frames them and sprays them so they stay together? Or
I haven't puzzled since I was like 10 years old. So
See, we Elise Wax and Brian Collins are also into puzzles. So like we will swap between the three of us occasionally. Like we'll bring them to trivia and be like, they finished with the Addams Family. Give me your Star Trek. And so, there's a whole puzzle ring going on.
Well, these are pretty big puzzles too. So I kind of almost feel bad just like putting them back in a box. So I would love to buy some puzzle glue, which Brian Collins did recommend to me, but it's sold out on Amazon.
This is
because
some nerdy ass shit.
Nerdy fucking shit going down here, man.
Well, I don't know what's nerdier. The fact that I desire puzzle glue, or the fact that it's already fucking sold out on Amazon, like because everybody's doing the same thing.
But it's a Jeff Spinell puzzle.
Who would have thought? We started with the Bulge.
Honestly, this all started by the puzzle companies. They were the ones. It's a big conspiracy.
Puzzle companies and Zoom.
Yes.
Nintendo Switch is like price gouge like shit right now. Like, I don't know how my mom scored Animal Crossing, but I tried to get my kids another game, and I wanted a couple for me, and those things are like so insane right now. So, it's a conspiracy.
Ridiculous.
My other hobby is fielding questions about the Halloween Kills trailer because we're coming up on the week. It's been it's like a week. This is the week we released it after the last film, but it's just I keep repeating it. It's like I have no news. Also, it would help if the theaters just opened up. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of hard to debut a trailer when the theaters are closed, because obviously that's maximum exposure.
Yeah, so, yeah, we have no idea.
Honestly, it'd be pretty nice to social distance in a movie theater. Can you imagine if you could only sit 6 feet apart from people?
I think that's what's gonna, Mallory, I think that's genuinely what's going to happen when theaters reopen.
They were trying that right before this closed down, where I was seeing pictures from theaters where they had seats taped off, and it was every other seat, every other row. So you were literally like sitting a good 4 feet from people, but then that becomes dangerous. So they quit. But now I'm figuring like you're going to be in there with a mask trying to figure out how to coordinate popcorn with.
I was going
to
say, how am I going to get my Arclight beer into my face mask?
It's like me when I fly, because I always wear a mask when I fly because I'm allergic to everything people are eating on the flight. And so it's always like, I have my bag of chips, but I can't take off my mask or I'll die. And so, yeah, it's always kind of a gamble. Yeah, stuff to consider for later. So what are you guys watching this week?
Twin Peaks.
Really?
Nice.
Really?
It was the big 30th anniversary of Twin Peaks. Oh. So I'm a huge David Lynch fan. I'm a huge Twin Peaks fan. And I'm sort of, it's one of those shows that I just kind of constantly have in the background.
By the names of your cats, we had no clue.
I love Lynch. But this was the 30th anniversary. So I was like, you know what? I am going to watch some more season 2. I sat down and watched Fire Walk With Me, which is, it's one of those films that, to me, is definitely a horror movie, and we're going to talk about monsters a little bit later. And Bob, I think, is one of my favorite cinematic monsters, just because he's so horrifying. And it's interesting that I don't think Shudder actually included it recently in one of their newsletters, but it's such a horror thing. And I was watching it, and I was like, this movie is fucked up.
It's his most horror movie, I'd say. I mean, there's elements of horror in almost all of them, but that one I think's the most. Yeah, I posted some Blue Velvet posters yesterday, and somebody commented on one of the alternate posters saying, oh, that looks like a lot like Laura Palmer because it was a body in a field. And I was like, well, it looks a lot like Laura Palmer because of his obsession with the Black Dahlia. And he actually had the rights to the Severed book that is like one of the best books I've read about the Black Dahlia as a person. It actually is about her, not just about the crime around her, which I thought's really kind of, he had the rights for years, and then he made Twin Peaks and no longer needed to make that movie because he made his own Black Dahlia myth, in a sense, which I thought was really interesting.
That's sort of what I love about Lynch, and there's a lot of criticism to be had about the way that Lynch handles his female characters, and I wouldn't call David Lynch a feminist filmmaker, but I do love Laura Palmer is my favorite TV character ever, and I think the way that he looks at her, and it's almost like a satire, you know, that she has so much character, but she's dead throughout the entire three seasons. Although depending on how you feel about who she is at the end of season 3. But I just, I absolutely love it. And I got to watch the live stream of Kyle MacLachlan and Machen Amik as they were talking about filming the pilot for season 1. And I was like, oh, that's so good. A little bright spot in the quarantine darkness.
Have you been watching chronologically again, or just kind of jumping to your favorite stuff?
I always watch chronologically. I just kind of have it on in the background. I'll put it on, you know, at night, or if I'm not, me and my boyfriend I'm not staying over at his place. I'll just kind of have it on in the background, and I just like to, it'll take me a few months to get through depending on which season it is, but I just like having it. I don't like jumping around just because, I don't know, I'm a nerd.
It's amazing. I think it's one of his best movies. If you actually rewatch the pilot, it's like it plays as like a perfect movie. It's really kind of an amazing piece of filmmaking.
Incredible.
An alternate cut where it is a movie and actually has a conclusion is so bizarre.
Oh, that weird European ending is so strange.
I think that's what I saw in New Zealand. I'm pretty sure that's what they played on TV when I was a kid in New Zealand. I'm pretty sure that's the version we saw.
It was spoiled for you right away.
I think so, that part. Well, I still didn't, because we didn't know what the fuck we were watching. That's the thing. It seems like a spoiler, but no one understood anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's hard to spoil David Lynch, because no one really knows what's going on.
The reason I asked the chronological question is because I haven't revisited the third season yet. I'm looking forward to it, but I really enjoyed, and I know Ryan too, it was kind of like, I really enjoyed the event of every week coming back to seeing a new episode of season 3 and really discussing it. And I had watched it with my friends Andrew Cash and Joe Madry. And there was a break somewhere there. I think it was after that. Was it episode 8 or 9 where it's like that atomic craziness? Or whatever.
Episode 8.
So after episode 8, I think there was a 2-week gap before there were new episodes. And my roommate and I at the time watched Lost Highway, and it literally felt like the appropriate next episode. And then like when we went to episode 9, like it's almost like, oh yeah, that's totally the in-betweener episode.
Actually, I could imagine Fred playing saxophone at the Twin Peaks bar that they did in that series. That would be amazing.
His weird acid jazz.
So you can consider Lost Highway your a lost episode and just
episode
watch
nine.
It.
It's episode 9, yeah. 8.5, I like it.
Wow. What are you guys watching?
Now I want to revisit all of Twin Peaks.
Me too. We got time.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. What better time?
Yeah, really.
Elric, what are you watching these days?
Me? I watched a few things. I watched a couple things I didn't care for much and something that was like mind-bendingly brilliant. I saw the rest of the Cursed film episodes and absolutely floored by the series now. I went in the biggest skeptic.
Oh, wow.
The first episode didn't do much for me. It did a couple things that I thought felt just off. And the director wrote to me at one point, just explained a couple things behind the scenes, and then I watched the rest of them. And my God, these things are, it's so smart what they do. They basically take this idea of cursed films and then do the exact opposite of what I was expecting, which is basically ground it in the emotions of what has been lost in these movies and say kind of basically fuck that noise of curse, what actually human error, human loss. And it puts a real face, the Crow one, particularly in the Twilight Zone one, which is the last just messed me up. Like the Twilight Zone one really goes into the process of some of the stuff that went down. Some of it I knew from the book, but other stuff just, there's certain people that he gets are not the normal people. It's not John Landis. It's the production designer. And the production designer's story is just brutal.
That one broke my heart. I've seen that one too.
It's heartbreaking.
It's really tough.
And then the Crow one I just thought was brilliant because, you know, there's a couple of these stories that do kind of feel like curses in the sense that even whether you're a believer of these things or not, just feels like there's some sad through line, right? Forget about curses. The Omen one is the one that most felt to me afterwards. I was like, yeah, it's probably a real curse. It's like there's just too many things. When you watch the Omen one, it's like, yeah, and then we showed up, and then that electrician backed into a pole, and he got electrocuted and died. Then we passed this guy on the street. He fell down dead. Then we turned a corner. That guy died. It was just like, what the fuck is... And even Richard Donner is like, I don't know, man. It's like...
Yeah, the Omen one felt like it should have been the first episode, right? Like, it seemed like it... It set up what the series was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then Gary Sherman gives the most heart-wrenching interview, and we've had him on the show, and he just gives the most beautiful, you know, because I think there's a coldness attached
to the
industry. For Poltergeist, there's a coldness often where it's just like, and then these people finish the movie, but just when you hear him talk about going, no, we didn't want to finish this movie. We all wanted to never go back to work again because we lost this friend of ours who was a child, and then just going back and all the reasons. It's really, but it's also just good documentary filmmaking, and that's what I walked away really impressed. Honestly, it's five of my favorite things I've seen this year in general were a couple of those latter episodes. I was really taken with the format, and I hope they do more. There's some good Ryan's in quite a lot of the last.
Oh, yeah.
You set them up a lot.
No,
you're good in that. It's like, it's a good setup. Almost better than
I'm a good today. I'm a good setup guy.
Yeah.
I'm a good setup
just here
guy.
For the intro, and then you just
I mean, like, I honestly feel, you know, watching Poltergeist and then I watched Exorcist and Omen with my wife and kid, and they were like, Where are you? And I'm like, no, it's totally okay. There are actual people who are much smarter and masters of the craft and were actually engaged in the actual things that were happening on the set that need to talk. I don't need to be in there.
Yeah.
But I'm eager to see the next two, maybe.
Yeah. No, they're all
I hate really watching good. Myself
I
on TV.
I really hope they get another season of it because I found them to be... So if you haven't checked it out, honestly, I think it's one of the best things Shudder's done so far, besides horror noir, which is also great. So.
Yeah.
It added to the conversation. It didn't just feel like a rehash of all these articles we've read about these creepy stories. It was a new layer, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's the key. I mean, there's so many things like that are just like you could get everything from reading the Wikipedia article, mm-hmm. you know?
A Reddit thread, yeah, that's all it could be, yeah.
I'm glad that they played it like that because I was really worried when they had announced the show and we started getting press stuff. It doesn't necessarily indicate it that it goes in that direction. So when I was reading things about, you know, was there a curse on the Poltergeist set? I was like, felt like it was really cheapening a tragedy. So I'm glad that they really played it in a different direction.
I think you'll really like it, but I would probably start with not The Exorcist. Not that that's a bad episode. It's just the second half of it does something.
I heard there's an exorcism.
Just kind of clunky, but once you understand what the show is, if that had played three or four, I would have gone, oh, this is kind of like you guys being playful, but
You have to, if you guys haven't had a chance, check out Jade Cheel, who is the director. Check out his short film, Twisted. It's a short, like, it's a kind of an interesting precursor to what Cursed Films is, because it is about the urban legend that during the theatrical run of Twister, an actual Twister blew through a drive-in. Like, at the exact moment, a Twister blew through the drive-in screen. And it talks about how it began as a, like, as a point of conversation in a small town, and how it built out into this kind of basically fact. Like, everybody was like, no, this really happened. And everybody's like, no, didn't really happen. But it was just kind of interesting to talk about. It kind of focused on, you know, the source of an urban legend, the power of it, and then tying into the film Twister. It's really interesting. I think I played it South By, but when they had reached out about doing interviews, that was the first thing they had sent over to me. And I was just like, oh shit, Jay knows what he's doing. Cause it's balanced in such a way that it's not making fun of the townspeople who were perpetuating this myth. But it was pretty cool. You should check it out. I think it's on his, I actually think it's on his
Vimeo or something.
Website, jadecheel.com. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I watched a couple movies that I'll just throw in a couple quickies before we move on. I saw We Summon the Darkness, which I think was easily mistaken with Satanic Panic back when these were both in production.
They could have switched titles, and I would have been okay with it, because this one was actually about a Satanic Panic, and We Summon Satanic Panic was not
they
exactly
actually summon
about
a demon in that one.
Yeah, they summon a demon, so I feel like they could swap.
They should be a complete swap. I gotta say, this one just
let me make a phone call
for me. Yeah, this one.
I know, yeah.
Satanic Panic, I think, is a lot of fun and has a lot of gags. This is not that. This isn't a comp played for jokes, really. It took too long for the setup on this one to grab me. And by the time the twist, which is a really fun twist, about 30 minutes in, I was like, oh, cool. I dig the twist. And then for me, it just didn't deliver. So I don't want to go too deep into it. But it is, the setup is, it's got Alexandra Daddario. And
I'm so bummed out, because I love her. I fell in love with her when I saw the adaptation of Shirley Jackson's We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which I'm obsessed with.
So good. Oh my God, that book was everything to me.
Well, I don't think you might like this, though. That's the thing. I would say that this is definitely firmly in the foot of not my taste. And that's
this is not an Elric movie.
Yeah, I was very aware of that when I got a few minutes in. I was like, oh, okay, this isn't my bag. But it's about, you know, a group of girls going to taking a road trip to go to a metal concert. They look like they're...
I mean, that's me and Rebecca's shit, so...
Exactly. Right there. We're good.
Yeah. It has some twists.
Honestly.
You'd have to watch it before I don't want to give anything away on that, but it plays into it. But they go to a concert. They look like they're picking... There's a bit of a Jennifer's Body vibe at the start, but then it doesn't have the cleverness of Jennifer's Body ever again. I didn't find it to be a particularly clever script. It felt, to me, it kind of flatlines after the twist. But, you know, it just wasn't for me. But, of course, there's satanic killings happening, being blamed on the Satanic Panic. That's the background of the story. You launch into these three girls, they meet some guys, they go off together, and then stuff happens that I will not be the one to ruin for you today. But that one didn't fly for me. And then the other one I saw that I won't say I loved, but I kind of enjoyed watching it last night, was Fantasy Island, which got kind of it got kind of slammed when it came out. I don't know, bad timing. Ryan will probably stay quiet on this one. But I will say, no, but watching it late last night, I was like, it's gag after gag. It's setup after setup. There's a lot of, as Lee Winnell said a couple weeks ago, there's a lot of movie in this movie, which means in some ways it can't really fully handle all the ideas, because it's like Twilight Zone and Black Mirror and just all these things. But there's so much in it that it's also fun. It's not trying to be overly clever with the kind of film it is, but there was parts of it I actually kind of rather enjoyed. Late night movie. It definitely wasn't the turkey that I wasn't saying I was going to expect, but I was expecting it to be less than it was. And there's some pretty clever storylines. I think one of the problems is it's got so many ideas that having that many characters to chart their individual fantasies might have just made it a little too fat. you know? And it's maybe if it had been one clear protagonist, might have gotten the idea better. But, you know, I kind of had fun, late night movie. I don't, it's not, again, not my bag. It's not the kind of movie I seek out, but I was like, you know, I'm having kind of fun. Me and Beck were meant to see it in the theaters, but, you know.
Yeah, we were supposed to go see it in the theaters, and there was some reason that we didn't. I don't know.
It was called The
Reviews. Oh, yeah, that may have been it.
And then we changed our mind, I recall.
I remember that we had, like, queued up the tickets. So we were like, Friday night, man. And then we ended up doing something else. Yeah. So, yeah.
And then the virus took over. Where you can say
it was called Nightmare Island in France, apparently, because everything that comes from here is a nightmare to the French.
I can see that.
It's a pretty good title, though. I kind of like that.
Yeah, Nightmare Island is pretty cool.
I think it's one of my favorite posters of recent times.
The whole
The
island and the skull in the water is a pretty fucking cool image.
Oh, and the trailer.
And I thought the trailer was great. Yeah, I remember seeing the trailer and being, I think we saw it. It was some screening that we were at, like all of us were at, because I remember being like, that looks great, right?
It was underwater.
Was it in underwater? Okay, yeah. Because I was like, this looks amazing. And yeah. But I am now encouraged to rent it because of you.
I mean, I don't want to push that hard. Let me just say, my expectations were at the highest. I will say it has Henry from Henry of a Portrait of a Killer in a very
Michael
fun
Rooker.
Rooker.
Michael Rooker, the Rook.
His hair is insane in this movie. If you see this movie for one reason, it's to see his weird ass hair. His hair is doing some weird shit in this movie. I don't know what's
up. What happens when it grows out?
Yeah, it's weird.
Wow.
That Rooker hair got weird in that one. But, you know, like I said, it had some things about it that I thought were kind of fun.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, I'll jump in. I, too, watched We Summon the Darkness. And, yeah, I love the homage to what it's reflecting at. I love that it's kind of a letter to the kind of 1980s concert culture. It reminded me, there's this documentary that I absolutely...
Heavy Metal Parking Lot!
Fucking straight! Hell yes! Okay, so Heavy Metal Parking Lot was shot at the concert hall that was really close to my house. It has since blown up. They imploded it when I was in high school. It would have been like late 90s because I saw Marilyn Manson open for Nine Inch Nails there, and then like 3 weeks later, they blew it up.
I can't believe you got to go to the concert hall that
Metal Parking Lot was shot at. Yeah, it's crazy. Incredible.
Do you guys want to enter private chat for a while?
Yeah.
Judas freaking Priest.
What was that, the Turbo tour?
Oh my God, that was the Judas Priest tour. So yeah, it was... anyway, so it reminded me of that because the bulk of the first act is just them hanging out in the parking lot before the metal show. So I was really appreciating.
Accurate.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was really appreciating what they were kind of writing a love letter to. I wanted a little bit more in the third act, but that said, I had fun kind of getting to that point. And I thought the girl who was playing Val, the third girl, the quiet one. I liked her
a lot.
I thought she was a really good actress.
She's in something from last year, maybe Rust Creek or something. There's some movie she was in that she was really good, and I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, I felt like I want to see her in more.
I feel like I'm going to watch that movie. And do you folks ever see a film and you're like, I know that I can't be objective about this thing because it is so exactly designed for me that this might be a piece of hot trash, but it's so made for my weird interests that I'm going to love it.
Every aquatic horror film. I mean, literally, you can strap snakes on a shark and like send it into the desert. And I'm going to be like, fuck yeah, shark, snake, desert man. And I'm going to fucking love it. And there's just no way to be objective in any capacity. As I'm wearing my shark sweatshirt in standing in front of my shark sculpture. There we go. So, yeah. I have a dog.
Animals.
Welcome to
Animals, kids, everywhere.
Poe.
Yeah, sorry. My second David Lynch-themed cat, who is my familiar and is always with me, is desperately trying to sit directly on my keyboard. That is her one dream, is to just be sitting directly there, and I won't let her.
Aww. Sidebar, so, I have found Heavy Metal Parking Lot on Tubi. So if anyone wants to watch that.
I used to have the DVD and it got lost in one of my many, many Los Angeles moves. And I have mourned it ever since.
I have a VHS copy of it. It's great. So I think it's only like 20 minutes long.
Yeah,
yep.
So yeah, definitely check it out. So
I always like to play it for people who are like, characters don't really act like that. People who write metalheads are so unrealistic. And I'm like, have you watched Heavy Metal Parking Lot, though?
Yeah, there was a lot of this that I was really appreciative of. Like, they were wearing back patches. And I was suddenly like, I had a Warrant back patch when I was in seventh grade and thought it was I made a Gwar video. Oh my God. So, no, Gwar was, that was a big deal in my life. So yeah, that is awesome. But yeah, no, I was totally getting down with the down boys in seventh grade with my Warrant back patch. But yeah, the fact that they were kind of like winking at things like this, I really appreciate it.
I got Ryan's attention.
Well,
raised eyebrow on everything.
That's an opening song, Ryan.
Since you're talking heavy metal parking lot stuff, have you ever heard, it's a comedy from the 2000s called the Darwin Awards. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I've heard of the Darwin Awards.
The actual Darwin Awards are people that die in the most stupid possible way. Yeah, so they made a movie about it. The movie's just okay, but there is one segment that is like 5 or 10 minutes long, and it's Judah Friedlander and Lucas Haas going to a Metallica concert. It is the funniest segment. Like, the whole movie's worth it to see these two guys and how they die horribly at a Metallica concert. And it just, it reminds me, we're talking about Heavy Metal Parking Lot. It just, those guys are these guys. So, Darwin Awards, if you could find, it's probably on YouTube, that skit.
Produced by Jason Blum.
Get out of here, really? Holy smokes.
Yeah, it was one of his early days, early attempts at comedy.
Wow.
You heard of it as an attempt.
Jason will probably admit it as well. I mean, like, he did the Tooth Fairy and it wound up being like, with The Rock, and it wound up being, it was an experience. That's why he like decided not to kind of get out of the comedy world and get out of big budget movies to do low budget horror.
Wow.
Nice. I've never seen Darwin Awards.
Honestly, that one skit is. I'm going to find it and send it to you guys because it's so good.
Yeah. I did a Scream binge. I watched 4 movies within the Scream franchise and one called Scream Dreams. So I'm going to do the Scream quadrilogy first. And this has been a long time coming since we've been debating over the last year about what is the best sequel and how they
rank.
It's four, obviously. Oh, God. Oh, stop.
Especially when you watch it out of context, it's great. Way ahead of its time.
Sure. No, it falls officially, and I tweeted this out. It was like Scream, Scream 2, Scream 4, and Scream 3. Scream 3 is pretty bad. Wow. It's pretty bad. But it is a necessary sequel because what they got right about it is tracking not only Sidney Prescott's journey, but also the mystery of what her mother was all about, and obviously it's a third chapter and you probably didn't need to go this far, but in the third chapter you learn that, Sidney's mom, before she met Sidney's dad, moved to Hollywood for 2 years and then got caught up in some nasty Hollywood business by falling in line with Lance Henriksen's producing character, who is Harvey Weinstein. And then what happens is, something terrible happens to her. And then it kind of bleeds through to her life into Woodsboro. And then through that, Sid has to face off with a brother she didn't know she had. And I love all of that. All of that stuff with her brother is fantastic. I love the fucking third act of that movie. Scream 4 is fine. It's totally fine. We have to admit, it's fine. It looks terrible.
Put that blurb right on the cover of the Blu-ray.
It's fine.
It looks terrible, but it's fine.
I mean, look, here's the thing.
Right next to my quote, best one yet.
There's a generation of horror fans who probably caught up to Scream 4. And that was maybe the first horror movie they ever saw in the theater, or it was the first entry they saw, or whatever, who I think give it a lot of love because there's a sense of nostalgia to it, which is fine. That's cool. I mean, there's tons of movies from the 80s that I fucking love because they're my firsts. They're my first movie that I saw. The Psycho 3 I have a soft spot for because it was the first one I had ever seen because I was over at my grandmother's house, But Scream 4... you know, you got to see it from this perspective, Scream 4 after seeing, you know, the trilogy, and then having so much built up over 10 years of anticipation of Wes Craven coming back and bringing everybody back to the table for a story that feels basically the same old thing. Like, Sid comes home, suddenly murders start occurring. Guess what? It's somehow tied into her family legacy. You know, it's just like, okay, after 10 years, that's the best concept you got. And you can cite, well, they comment on reboots, they comment on sequels, they comment on all that kind of stuff. That's fine, but those are very small notes in a very large, you know, piece. So I mean, Scream 4 is fine. It is better a sequel than 3. But yeah, I did the whole. I mean, I'm very, very happy. I just sat down and just revisited all 4 over the course of 2 days.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing you on.
I will say, I feel like the more anticipation the next installation of a horror franchise or any film franchise, can any of you? I mean, we can all probably count on one hand the amount of next installations with 10 or plus years gone that really, really deliver.
And a lot of times, I think that they're not necessarily. Yeah, a lot of times, I don't necessarily think that they're the ones that I think deliver are not necessarily the ones that continue the story, but the ones that kind of reboot and do something completely different. Like Evil Dead delivered like crazy for me. But it kind of reinvented the universe in a good way. So, yeah.
I think it's really tough because, I mean, we see it time and time again. There's so many new franchises that are being rebooted right now, both in the horror universe, but also, you know, Star Wars. We're rebooting everything, and there's a weird fine line you have to walk between doing a new thing, fan service, all these things. And I actually can't think of that many movies across any genre that have actually been a new installment in a franchise and people were like, oh wow, that's fucking great.
You know what? Strangers 2 is actually pretty good compared to, you know, I mean, like there was a good 10-year break between those two films. Mm-hmm. And Johannes came to the table with, you know, more of the same, but a different family being stalked by the strangers. But he managed to put some new, you know, his thumbprints are all over it. And I think we can all agree, like the pool scene is like one of the best horror scenes.
I show that in my class now and have my students break it down. I need to bring them in to talk about it, but I have them break it down beat by beat as how to construct a murder set piece. Yeah. It's a really good example of like a perfectly constructed one.
Yeah. I just kind of wish, I mean, like, you know, I imagine there was the horror fan base that's much older than us. Like when Day of the Dead came out, you know, I look at old Fangorias and I look at old Cinefantastiques and I look at like the kind of fan letters that come in, and there was a level of vitriol leveled at that movie, and because it wasn't Dawn of the Dead. But now, you know, however many decades later, it is applauded. It's a great sequel. It's a great capper to that trilogy. And I kind of just wish that I don't know, maybe I'm just glutton for punishment. I keep going in to Scream 4 after these long breaks, hoping for that same thing. Maybe there's some sort of spark that rekindles it, but I don't find it. I don't know why. It's so weird.
I've heard it's the best one.
I've said it before, and I'll say it
again. Scream 2 is the best sequel.
No. It's, you know, look, it depends on how you as a fan want to revisit these things, and I agree with Mallory, and the thing I learned in the last, I don't know, decade or so, especially as a horror fan, is that it's really hard to judge a sequel on its own if you are in the process of marathoning them. Yeah, Scream 4 feels really repetitive after you sit through 2 and 3, but if you watch it completely with whatever your memory is of Scream, you're kind of like, oh, okay, this makes sense. You know, it's not the movie I wish it was when it came out, because like you, I thought they were going to double down on commenting on torture porn and found footage and all that kind of stuff. But that's kind of how I approach sequels and remakes now, is I try to watch them not in sequence. It's like, again, like Alien 3 is a movie that I always hated because I'd always watch it on the heels of Alien and Aliens. And then there was just 1 year that I just watched it pretending I just jumped right to 3, pretending I hadn't seen anything. If you don't have that baggage of who Ripley is and Newt and all that stuff, if you just watch it as a science fiction movie and you're like, all right, I don't know who this girl is, but she just crashed into this desolate island or whatever. All right, I'm with this story. It's a little easier to swallow. It's really hard to.
But is that the way to go into a sequel? I mean, it's the third part of a. I mean, like Scream 4 is coming with a lot. There's a lot of baggage to it dramatically. You know, there's like, you know, Dewey and Gale's relationship. There's obviously Sid's history. I mean, like, I kind of feel like you have to come to the table with some of that knowledge to understand the. I mean, I guess like looking at it separately on its own, I can understand looking at it from a production standpoint or a craft standpoint. But to understand understand the story and appreciate it, I think you have to kind of. It's kind of hard to look at it on its own. Like Alien 3, I don't know if I can appreciate on its own without knowing where Ripley's been.
Mm. I do the same thing Rob does. Whenever a new installation in some franchise comes out, I actually, I am coming on this podcast as an author. I do this with books and films. The first time I read or watch something that's like the next in a series or next in a franchise, I try to go in, I won't rewatch things. I just go in totally raw, trying to take it for what it is, because I feel like a really good filmmaker will make a good movie that people can kind of jump into. And then I like to do either read it or watch it again. And then I let my nerd out, and then I can really dig into it and part like, you know, rewatch things and dig into all the Easter eggs and things that are connected between characters and whatever. But I like the very first one to try to be as standalone as possible, because again, I feel like a really good filmmaker, a really good author will give you something that you can, if you need to have an encyclopedic knowledge of the entire series to understand what's going on, you're probably not a great filmmaker.
Well, there's definitely I agree with you. There is definitely a balance. I mean, you have to me, I guess it's just, what each individual wants to go to the table, you know, come into the movie with. But when I...
Choose your own adventure. How dirty do you want
to be? Hey, look, we're coming back. You're speaking to the guy that was part of the Halloween Choose Your Own Adventure. You don't want
to
do...
I think you're suited to be able to talk about this, especially taking up something that there was such a huge gap and there was such a legacy to reckon with. You know, there's a way to do it. And I think that's what's interesting about franchise film, like series that, you know, especially take place over 20, 30 years and have such a huge fan base and such a, like, there's people who have watched every single frame of every single movie and picked out everything there to try to find a way to experience it differently, but also, you know, balance that nerd in you that wants to sit down and figure out, like, ooh, is that brand of jeans that she's wearing? Is that the one that she was wearing in the first installation of this franchise? Oh my gosh. So it's an interesting way that there's so many different ways for all of us to experience these films as they come out.
Yeah. And I think, what's so funny is I think that level of fan obsession has only grown over the last few decades. Like, I don't remember.
It's the internet.
Yeah,
oh my God,
I don't
get even worse.
And that's what we love to do. We love to argue. So do it.
I just don't remember going into some of the sequels of the 80s, you know, going, oh my God, there's that. I mean, like, obviously that stuff you catch up to much later on in life, but the internet.
I just don't think we had the means back then.
No.
We didn't have the ability to play the thing on our phone and take a screenshot and then zoom into it, you know?
And because we didn't own them and we couldn't watch them in excess, I think that a lot of it was at that point in time, I hadn't seen Friday 3 enough to know exactly what was going on to critique how it compared to Friday 6 and things like that.
Yeah.
But that said,
yeah, I think films now have a harder time than they did back then.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah. And you know what? Can I rant about something really quick? I this week saw the release of all of those really cool Dune photos. The first look at Denny's Dune, and I noticed on Twitter, like, the first wave of things that happens is, oh my God, it's the first look at Dune. Look how amazing this is. The second thing that happens is taking the piss out of the photos and going, oh, I'm going to recolor Oscar Isaac's armor so it makes a funny. And then I'm like, can we just let stuff live for a second before we dive into making comedy out of every little fucking minutia of a film before it fucking opens? It made me so, I was so bummed yesterday over morning coffee. I was just like, I saw like
everybody. And that was freezing. Yesterday.
And that was yesterday. One day. Yeah. I was like,
wait. Was that was like last week, guys. That was pre-COVID. It had to be.
You know what? It was like classic old man Turek. I was sitting there going, why has everybody got to be a fucking comedian?
I will say this. So they released the one image. That's the only one I've seen, right?
Oh, there's the whole.
Yeah, there's like, character shots of everyone.
Oh, well, I just saw that one, and everyone's like, oh, my God, oh, my God. And it did make me laugh out loud. Brian Fuller shared the image and said, I'm bored already. it just made me laugh out loud.
Oh, man.
So, anyways.
Well, I watched a franchise film this week that I'll call it a short-lived franchise. I wish it was still going. I watched Slumber Party Massacre 2. Which in no way feels like it needs to be part of the first one, but it somehow is slightly. This is 1987, directed by Deborah Bach, who knocked it out of the park with this so much that I wish she had done more stuff. Like, I wish she had like a full, massive body of film work.
When I first came to LA, she's the person I had lunch with most. Like, I would have lunch with her every couple months. She lives in the desert, and she's the funniest woman I've ever met. Like, she's
hilarious. I want
hilarious.
To meet her now. I was so just inspired by this movie.
She produced Brown Bunny and Buffalo 66. So she's like this weird, and her Vincent Gallo stories are like, oh, okay. That's why you can't work with Vincent Gallo. Like,
now I really want to have lunch with her.
She's really cool.
So yeah, this was produced by Roger Corman, follow-up to his first one. And I have a feeling that Roger's message, just judging by how it's edited and how it works, was make it kind of Elm Street. Because that's how the whole film functions, is it feels like Nightmare on Elm Street, where this guy is appearing in her dreams, this wild rockabilly guy with these amazing nightmare set pieces of blood and decapitations and crazy shit happening, and all of this wild, wild effects. And I'll get to my favorite one in a second. But he just keeps appearing in a dream. And then she'll wake up and her friends are like, why are you screaming? And she's like, I don't know. And then she keeps saying he's coming, but no one believes her. And so then the whole setup of it is a group of high school girls who are also in a really fun band where they play in their parents' garage. They apparently, one of the girls' dad just bought this new condo in a place called, it's like Desert Village or something. It's Santa Clarita. And
I'm there with my band right now. We're all doing this out here.
And he's away for the weekend. And so the place is completely empty with all of his booze. And so they're going to go to his fancy new condo and drink all of their booze and invite all their boyfriends over. And so they do. And the first night, the guys aren't supposed to be there. None of the guys are supposed to show up for the second night. So the first night, I now understand why guys have this connotation of what goes down at female slumber parties. And I swear it's based off this movie because literally they get in there and they're like, let's dance. And so then they're dancing to Rock and Roll High School because it's a Corman film. And so I guess he could get some of the music from it. Yeah. And so they're dancing to it while watching it on TV and they've all got beers. And then it becomes, Brenda, you spent your beer all over my shirt. I'll just take it off. And then bras come off. And then the pillow fights start. And then now we're naked, covered in booze, with pillow fights. And that's when the guys burst in who weren't supposed to be there yet. But I swear that this is where every understanding of what you think happens at a slumber party happened from here on out. So that goes down. And so then it just slowly, this girl starts unwinding where she starts the nightmares start getting more and more vivid. She starts having these daydreams. The most amazing one, it's just this killer effect, is one of her friends has a zit, which is just like a minor plot point at the beginning of like, I think I'm getting a zit. By this, it's pretty climactic where she comes in and she's like, I was just buying zit cream for my zit. And it's like tiny. And then it cuts back to her and she's like, but you were gone for hours and I saw your death. And then when she comes back, it's like huge and pulsating. Ugh. And then she's like, oh my God.
It's like
God,
a razor hit suddenly. It's so crazy.
And then it cuts back to her. And the way that it's shot is so clever where it's like overs, but slowly, it's not even slow. Like it's overs, but every time they go back to her, it's doing something different. And it's really wild to the point where it's actually like a geyser of pus, like spraying at her.
Yeah.
It's this amazing set sequence in it. And then there's the killer, and the killer is just crazy, just this crazy rockabilly guy with this heavy metal-ish guitar, but there's a drill on the end of it, and he's black leather fringed out, and it's just a blast. I love this movie, is what I'm saying.
As soon as I saw this, I remember looking it up and like and being obsessed of who this guy was, because it was the only thing he ever did, and he was the heir to the Little Caesar fortune. And they also owned the Detroit Red Wings. And I was like, no wonder he gave it up. What? He did this one movie, and then he went back to being the heir of the...
Can you imagine that being your one film?
I know, it's so crazy. Know. Like,
now, back to Little Caesars for some crazy bread. But I did myself.
You think he got Little Caesars for everyone on the set?
I would hope so. Yeah, it is a pizza-centric movie, as we know from the first. So,
I've always
the part three is a shame because the first two are so lively, and then the part three, I'd like to see it again. It's been a long time, but I always remember it just falling completely flat. It was still a woman director. All three are directed by women, so that was the one thing Corman did.
God, Rebecca, can you reboot that? Because I would love to see you direct a reboot of something like that.
Love to reboot. Oh my God, that's like a dream project of mine. Hell yeah. But no, because I had hosted the screening of the first one at the New Bev last year. And then this one, I happened upon this because I was on Amazon Prime, and this is currently streaming on Amazon Prime. And immediately it was because after We Summon the Darkness, I was thinking of heavy metal films, and I started Googling heavy metal films to see if I'd missed any. And then I was suddenly like, this one. And then I saw it was on Prime. And so, yeah, it is just a pleasure to revisit. So I highly recommend Slumber Party Massacre 2. It's on Amazon Prime right now.
It's also, I mentioned this on one of the Just the Discs, but since we're all stuck at home, I've been kind of obsessively looking through all the streaming services, especially the free ones. And Shout Factory has a really good one, Shout Factory TV, which is all free. And it's a lot of their Scream Factory, Shout Factory library, HD transfers. You get a couple ads while you watch it, but that's Slumber Party Massacre's on there, 1 and 2, along with some of the special features. So if you want to see that, I have a couple of quick ones I'll throw out. I've been just diving into a bunch of documentaries on Amazon Prime because they just have such an excellent selection. And I found a documentary called Fright Fest, Beneath the Dark Heart of Cinema. For listeners of this, you probably know that Fright Fest is a long-going great horror festival in the UK. I got to go back in 2018 or so. But it's great. It's a great celebration, and it's kind of one of the early. Usually, a lot of films get like their early debut, at least over in that part of the world, at Fright Fest. This was made 2 years ago by a director named Chris Collier, and there are four very big personalities behind this festival. And what's cool about it is, I mean, we attend festivals sometimes, we hear about them, etc. But I've never really heard a story quite like this one about, I mean, it felt like the formation of a band. It's like four very unlikely, crazy personalities that were thrown into this thing because they all had a love of genre movies. And before you know it, it's like Del Toro is showing up to premiere Hellboy there. And then the year later, he insists on Pan's Labyrinth having its UK premiere at the Fright Fest. It's really cool. It goes through the entire history of the very first couple all the way up until about 2018. And it interviews all the key people. But more importantly, the thing I love about it is it talks to a lot of the attendees. There's actually one guy named Sheraton Knott who listens to our show. He's rocking his Shockwave shirt in the documentary. So there's that, which I was very proud of.
Oh, whoa. Thank you, Sheraton.
Yeah, he's great. I met him at Fright Fest the 1 year that I went, and he gave me those magazines that who was it? Was it not Jim Jarmusch? Maybe it was Jim Jarmusch. No, Alex Cox used to do a review magazine. And he gave me a reviewing genre cinema stuff.
In the UK.
Yeah, he gave me a bunch of those when I went to Fright Fest. And I think that's the cool part of the story is that not only did this thing kind of come together by sheer will, but basically the first year that somebody showed up, like they became a regular. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of how we have our own horror community here in Los Angeles. And anytime we trek out to some of the other conventions across the country, we kind of see a lot of the same faces and stuff like that. This is that thing, that celebration for the UK, for London. And it's cool. It's a lean, mean little 90-minute documentary that celebrates just getting together to see movies. And right now, again, you know, we're all missing going to the theater. This was kind of a fun little you know, way to celebrate that. So just search Fright Fest on Amazon Prime and you'll find this there. The other two I'll be really quick about was I finally watched Godzilla King of the Monsters in 3D because I was waiting to watch it in 3D. It's like, if I'm going to watch Godzilla fight
I finally watched that last week as well, because I was on book tour last year when it was out in theaters, and I literally was just traveling every single, for like a month straight, every single time it was gone, I could have gotten the chance to watch it, and I had been dying to see it because I'm a huge Godzilla fan, and I finally watched it for the first time last week.
Yeah, I had a blast with it, and I kept thinking, because a lot of people, look, it's light on plot. There is plot there. But really, it was kind of a 180 of the last one from 2014, which was like Godzilla doesn't show up for an hour into that movie. And like, it's entertaining to an extent, but especially in 3D, it's like you could definitely see Michael Dougherty, Trick or Treat's Michael Dougherty, he wrote and directed this one. You could 100% see that it's like a little 12-year-old that watches these movies that's like, I just want them all to fight each other. Like, I'll figure out a way to make them all come out, but who cares? Like, I just wanted to show up and fight. And you definitely get that in spades here. The few things I'll say, it's really funny. I remember when the movie came out in theaters, somebody was complaining, like, you can't just have 2 hours of monsters fighting. And Matt Serafini, who's on our show, author.
You fucking can't.
he retweeted saying, I reject your hypothesis. I was like, it's perfect.
I always laugh at people who go to see a kaiju movie or any kind of big monster movie, and they're like, oh, the human characters weren't great enough. It always feels like someone who goes to a steakhouse and then orders a salad and complains about it. I'm like, why do you care?
That's how I felt when people were complaining about The Grudge versus The Ring movie.
Oh, God, I love that movie. Diaco.
I thought it was so great. And they were like, I just didn't really feel the emotion in this one. It didn't. I'm like, you're not supposed to. It's Sadako fighting Kyako. No. Fuck that shit. Just have them go at each other. And they could have cut out
quite literally all of the... I definitely understand. I got a little tired of some of the human stuff that was going on, except for the guy... who went to like go into Godzilla's lair. I was obsessed with him. I love him very much. I can't remember. Ken Watanabe?
Yeah. Yes. He's great.
I love him. If it was just like him, that would have been fine. But all of the monster fighting stuff, again, just give me monsters fighting. Like, I don't care about anything else.
Well, and Mothra is so beautiful, especially in 3D. So colorful. Oh. I was like, this is exciting. But here's the weird thing. And
Before you move from Mothra, can I show this to my daughter? Like, is there questionable shit in this one?
I think you can. Okay. I mean, there's a lot of violence, but there isn't any sex. There isn't the violence. I mean, the only thing that I think would be tough to show a kid is there's the scene with Ken Watanabe and he kind of sacrifices himself, and that might be tough to explain to a kid, but I don't. I mean, the main character is 11 from Stranger Things. Like,
oh, wow. Okay.
Also, I do want to say on a monster note, I was in the middle of having book tour before for the paperback for my book before all this started happening, and one of the last events that I did was actually in introducing a screening of Slumber Party Massacre up at the Alamo Drafthouse in San Francisco, and I had a woman who came to my signing afterwards, and she was telling me how her daughter is getting really, really into monsters, and she got into it because of Stranger Things, because of 11, and like the Demogorgon is like her Godzilla. Wow. And I never thought about how Stranger Things is like ushering a whole new generation of kids into monster stuff. Yeah. I like got all emotional because this little girl was like all obsessed with monsters and I was like, oh, I love you. I just hadn't thought of Stranger Things in that way.
Yeah. I mean, the crux of the movie, which I think will go over Marnie's head anyway, but like, I mean, it opens basically with the last movie, 2014, and our main couple loses their child in that attack. So that, but you don't see it or anything. It's just kind of that sets everything off. Which, by the way, Mallory, tell me if you felt this way too when you watched it. But like last night, I'm glad I watched it now. But considering the pandemic, it's not much of a plot, but the motivation, which is basically, you know, this is a mild spoiler, but basically it's like, we need this to cleanse the earth. We need the monsters to come out. And we basically need something to wipe most of us out so that, you know, the natural balance can be struck. It's in the form of giant monsters, but I definitely was like, I'm pretty scared right now, I think.
I will say, I will take COVID-19 over King Ghidorah.
It's like The Stand, but monster form.
Yeah.
I actually thought that was really interesting. I thought some of the motivations for some of the characters were a little off, but I genuinely enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the monster designs. Some of the things were a little convoluted, but I love a giant monster movie.
But hey, how about that Rodan reveal? You know, I mean, like, yeah, it's like all I mean, I got the 4K and I just threw on, I just immediately jumped to Rodan's introduction, because not only do you have Rodan, then you've got everybody on the stealth bomber that apparently just kind of doesn't need gas. But I love all of that. You know what? It's like the movie is a giant Saturday morning cartoon, which is what I kind of love about it. And you're you accept that they're all on this massive ship that just flies all over the world, and it's okay. And that you accept that this thing can outmaneuver Ghidorah. I mean, like, that's the beauty of that scene, is like, it's Rodan. And then suddenly they're like, sir, there's something on the radar and it's big. And you're like, and then suddenly Ghidorah shows up and you're like, fuck yeah.
Do we get Gamera action? Is he in on this?
No.
Gamera? No Gamera.
I will say, it is very funny because it feels like, you know when you're watching a film in a franchise and you're like, this feels like such a second film, because a lot of the big action in this movie takes place in Boston. Yeah. And you're like, I know you guys are building up to motherfucking New York City. You don't want this to be in Boston, okay? This is like your second tier. I'm from Boston, so like, this is like your second tier city. You're definitely building up to Godzilla versus King Kong in the Big Apple. I get it, but it was very funny because I'm just like, Boston, really?
Well, I'm sold, guys. Guess what I'm watching with my kids this week?
Yeah, you should.
You're like King of the Monsters.
Yeah. I never worry about deaths, because honestly, like, every Disney film opens with a dead mom. It's just how they open the movie. Yeah. It's like, and her mom died, catalyst for the rest of the movie. Yeah. So I never worry about that. Sex is the only thing that I'm like strict on, but yeah. So
there is Mothra. Well, okay. Yeah,
Mothra then we're gets going. Total Mothra sexiness.
How does
Charles Dance has sex with a Mothra?
Oh, well, you had me at Charles Dance had sex. Who doesn't want to see that?
That got weird.
I still haven't seen Kong Skull Island, and that one looked really good.
That was good.
I loved it.
Kong Skull Island is truly exactly like being on a ride at Disneyland. Okay, like, if you go into it feeling like you're on a theme park ride, it's the best part.
That's
almost
really good.
Every single person in that film except for John C. Reilly can be replaced by like a mop with a hat on, but John C. Reilly and all the monster stuff make it worth it 100%. Okay, cool.
Right. Yeah, it's a similar approach to this new Godzilla. Basically, it's like, that's what's been missing from Kong movies. It's like, I just want to see Kong fight a lot of monsters, not just one snake or whatever. Skull Island delivers. He just fights everything you could think of on that thing, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That's
a great trip.
Well, it's hard to follow Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Yeah, I had another one, but I'm going to save it for next week because I can't follow Godzilla.
But I've got. This was my segue. I was segueing into Scream Dream from 1989. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Not related to the Scream movies at all.
No. When I mentioned it earlier, I was actually mentioning an actual film called Scream Dream.
I assumed
you were talking about a documentary.
No.
That just sounds like a documentary name.
Yeah. Coincidentally, my entire weekend was just Scream titled movies. But this is from Donald Farmer. When I found this on Night Flight, and it begins with a woman on a bed. She looks pretty comfortable and she's having good sleep in her silk sheets, but then suddenly a chainsaw pops up between her legs through the mattress and then cuts her in two. And then you segue into the actual
common occurrence.
Yeah, it's very I mean, like, I was just like, been there, done that. But this is the story of a, tying into We Summon the Darkness. It's the story of a heavy metal group led by a female, singer who goes from city to city on her tours, seducing men and then killing her concert goers.
And what's the name of this again?
Scream Dream.
writing this one.
Oh, Beck, now, Beck, now Becca's writing us down. Now Becca's
heavy
writing
metal. Yeah, I assumed it was one of your standard slashers. Now that we're a heavy metal girl band on tour,
yes.
I'm in.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Spring Green.
Yes.
In watching it this week.
So well, proceed with caution, you two. I mean, this is you know, keep in mind. I think this was produced somewhere in maybe Wisconsin or Idaho or something like that, and you know, they have zero budget. But yeah, basically, you know,
is it better or worse than Rock and Roll Nightmare on the scale of quality?
I think it's worse than Rock and Roll Nightmare.
I kind of love Rock and Roll Nightmare.
I love Rock and Roll Nightmare so much.
Yeah, yeah. Thor, it's Thor. I love Thor. Yeah. Not in like a sexy way, but just like, oh, you're so cute type Thor.
Yeah.
But anyways, this goes into the, once this band's manager who wants to kind of ignore the fact that, I got to back up. So in this town, the manager discovers that there are concert goers going missing, and he's watching the news, and there's this woman, the newscaster, with her microphone in hand, because that's what newscasters, anchors do. And she's standing in front of a green screen where there's nothing on the green screen. And she's talking about how these people are going missing. And the guy's like, this bitch, this crazy, what the fuck? No one's listening to me. And he's being incredibly rude about it. And suddenly the guy's secretary walks in. She's like, the reporter is here to talk to you. And he goes, what? And suddenly the reporter that was just on the news comes walking through the door with just a microphone. Nothing else. No other sound equipment. No cameraman. And she's like, "I want you to."
Works,
right? He's like, "I want you to go on the record and tell me what's happening with your band and blah blah." And so it's those kinds of weird little eccentricities that make it charming.
That's the low budget shit I live for.
Oh my god! You're gonna get so
you see reporters in movies and they'll touch their ear like they're touching an earpiece, but there's nothing there. I've seen it so often where it's like, "I'm getting a report from the studio. There's nothing there."
I'll cut it short. I'll cut this short, but basically. If you're in for a heavy metal rock chick who gets replaced by a blonde heavy metal rock chick who wants to get possessed by the devil but hasn't participated in human sacrifices but then encounters a sock puppet demon thing, then this movie is for you.
Ryan, I'm into all of this.
You are just listing off amazing things for me and Rebecca to enjoy. Yeah.
Go for it. It took
we're gonna have a slumber party. We're gonna watch this.
It took me three sittings. Because it was one of those movies that I was like, oh shit, this is on Night Flight. This looks really interesting, and it also looks like a slasher I've never seen. So then I got about 5 minutes into it, and I fell asleep. And then I woke up 40 minutes later and I rewound all the way back to that 5 minute mark and tried to rewatch it again and I fell asleep. So then I said, all right, I'm going to give up. So the next night I did it again, got about an hour in, fell asleep. So then I just sat, I got up like on a weekend morning and just like plowed through it.
Oh, sold. My God.
Yeah.
You just sold me. You didn't sell me a heavy metal. You sold me out of four sleep.
So it's not a documentary, but a weird shot on video gem from the late 90s.
You need to chase this up with Scream and Scream Again. Wait, Scream for Help, the Michael Winner one, is the perfect ending to your Scream night. Help, I think that's the way to end. Yeah. Mallory, did you have another one that you've been watching?
I will say there are, in the world of Amazon Prime, there are a lot of really amazing old cheesy horror movies screening right now. Me and my boyfriend recently watched My mother is a werewolf, or my mom turned into a werewolf, or something like that. It's like an old made for TV movie. I'm actually really, really desperate to like write a reboot of it, because I was like, this could actually. You ever watch any of these old shitty movies and you're like, this could actually be really good if I tried?
And I have a theory that Manos Hands of Fate could be brilliant if the right screenwriter was behind it. So yes, I agree with your theory.
But it's so amazing. It's basically about this mom, the suburban mom, and everything's told from the perspective of her daughter and her daughter's like funky friend. And the mom gets bitten by this like sexy guy who's actually a werewolf. And hold on, let me look this up, because the werewolf is actually played by a famous genre actor. So werewolf, let me see. I cannot remember his name, but it's kind of a cool exploration of like the desolation and like the sadness of suburban moms. in like how
I'm gonna guess they Paul Naschy is my guess, but everyone should take a guess. Which genre actor will be the
what is his name? Is it John Saxon?
I'm gonna go with Oliver Reed.
Saxon's been a lot. Yeah, Reed's definitely a werewolf.
It's John Saxon.
I've never seen Saxon.
It is
play
John Saxon. Okay.
All right.
And he plays the sexy werewolf, and it is extremely hilarious, and it's just so cheesy because it's like all the it's basically like walking this kid through the horror of her mom having a sex life, and she's so freaked out because she's cheating on her dad with this werewolf, but and like the mom is slowly turning into a werewolf. It is. I love a shitty horror movie, so if you were just sitting around and like having some beers and looking for a fun movie to just like enjoy and laugh at and not take too seriously. Yeah, that's what it's called. It's called My Mom's a Werewolf. It came out in 1989. Definitely made for TV. It is a blast. And it's on Amazon Prime for free.
Oh, wow.
I want to make a Your Mama remake of that. Yo Mama's a Werewolf. I think that'd be good. Anyway. I saw one like masterpiece, so I got to throw it in here at the end. It's one that I'd been meaning to see for years, and then Dick saw it, and I saw him post 5 stars. I was like, oh, when I see that 5-star in Letterboxd, I'm pushing play, and that is Burn Witch Burn, a.k.a. Night of the Eagle. This is one of the best films I've ever, like, this movie this is so good. I didn't even know you liked this one. Did you talk about
it? I recommended this like 6 times on this fucking show, Elric.
It was probably killer POV and no one listens to that.
It was that too.
Well,
this
anyway.
This is like in my top 10 movies of all time, and Elric.
I'll give you a chance because this is pure, it is pure gold. Like this is one of the best films about witchcraft I think I've seen. It's could literally be now my goal at the New Bev is to try to get them to someday play this with Curse of the Demon because they are almost the same movie, essentially. They're very similar. But here's the selling point because I didn't push play. But if somebody had told me this, 2 reasons I didn't watch this. A, I thought it was set. The post art makes it look like it's set in Salem in the witch time period, which it's not. It's a contemporary 1960 university setting. And the screenwriters are Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont. And Charles Beaumont.
What?
Yeah, exactly. So you're like, oh, it's going to be that kind of a story. Yeah, Charles Beaumont's responsible for, in my opinion, the best episodes of Twilight Zone. We all know all the great Richard Matheson stuff. I actually read some crazy stuff about Beaumont right before this. I did not know he died at 38 and he got a disease when he was like 37 that Yikes. Basically he looked 100 when he died. It aged him. So it's like a story out of Twilight Zone. He was 38 years old. Suddenly, in 1 year, he looked almost like he was 100 years old.
Is it progeria?
It was two diseases mixed. So he had, up, they said it was very uncommon and it hit out of nowhere. But in this year, 1962, he had four movies. He had Premature Burial. He had The Intruder, which is my favorite Corman film. He had Burn Witch Burn and something called Wonderful World of Brothers Grimm all in 1 year. This screenwriter is just on fire. And then he dies a couple years later. But this movie is somewhat between that. There was a movie we talked about a couple years ago called City of the Dead, which was a discovery a couple years ago, which is excellent. It has a tone of both that and Curse of the Demon. And then one moment in it at the start that is exactly like the best moment in Kill List. My favorite moment in Kill List is when they have a dinner party and this woman who just seemed innocuous goes into the bathroom and puts a weird hex curse on the freaking painting and puts it back on the wall. And you're like, what the hell is happening? It has a moment just like this in the opening. So it's a guy at university who's very, kind of attractive professor type who's flirting with his students and everyone respects him. And he goes home that night with his wife, and clearly there's some academic rivalry at this university. And his wife starts getting really upset this night after they've had a couple people over for dinner. And it's just totally hypnotic because it just grabs you. It follows the wife, upturn everything in the house, but hiding it from him that she's doing it because she's convinced that somebody has left some sort of witchcraft type thing in the house and she's feeling its vibe. He has no idea his wife is practicing witchcraft and what he teaches is rationality. So it's all about this teacher teaches to being rational and not being a believer. It even says, I do not believe on the chalkboard behind him in the opening scene. And by the end of the film, it says, I do believe. The wife stuff is super interesting. So she claims that she has been putting these people are out to get him in this town that they've moved to, and that all his success is because of this witchcraft she's been trying to practice, and he obviously doesn't believe it, makes her burn it all, and the short of it is then shit gets haywire and really dark for them. And some of the reveals are just, it's a really classily made movie. It's very well put together, and there's just something very hypnotic about the way it grabs you. It's black and white, but the writing, I think those guys write stories that are just layer by layer, you get deeper into it. How'd you first discover this one, Becca?
Well, a long time ago. Actually, if you, I don't even know if it's still on there, but if you go to the Blumhouse.com site, which is now the 13th floor, there's a big, long love letter I wrote to this movie from a couple of years ago. I think I refer to it as Night of the Eagle in the letter. I saw this in college. Like, I saw this long ago. Was one of the films I stumbled on in college. And I fell completely in love with this. And even just rewatching it a couple years ago when I did the Blumhouse article, the cinematography in this is just absolutely breathtaking. A lot of really like strong depth of field shots. Like one of the most famous ones is where you're staring at this eagle statue, but then it's shooting through a window on the other side of it with the back wall. And it's just... The cinematography is just breathtaking.
Well, there's that attack scene just like Curse of the Demon. It has almost the exact same buildup to a skeptic seeing something attack them in a very disturbing way. Yeah.
I always just kind of gathered that Romero watched this and somehow used it to fuel Season of the Witch. Because the notes and the way that they set up and the way that the males are portrayed in the film, it feels very similar, but this obviously predecessed it by about half a decade. So, yeah.
And this is a more successful genre film because Season of the Witch never really tries to be a genre film. Yeah.
Yeah. This feels very classy, though. Yeah. It is very much like a British, heavy, heady drama that happens to be about witchcraft, and really sets up really well done scares. And I think that that's a little bit of why it did not get the genre acclaim of a lot of other films from this time period, is just that it kind of sets itself up as being this kind of really classy film. And then it's just got these amazing scares in it. So,
I mean, it's literally one of the best films I've seen this year, period. Like, I was like, oh, this kind of movie. Like, so happy when you get one of those every year. I feel like I get like two or three nowadays, you know?
So, well, then I'm going to go into my 5-star because I know you've seen it too, Elric. And this was my 5-star letterbox for the week. And I'll be quick because I know we're running out of time. Was Woman in the Dunes from 1964. And this is one that I had seen before. It's a Criterion film, very classic work of like, this is a canon of cinema. And I happened upon a website a couple of days ago, which was talking about it in regards to it being a horror film. And I'd seen it in college, but I did not consider it a horror film. I just considered it like a Japanese drama from the time period. So I decided last night, it's on Prime for like $3. So I decided to rent it and rewatch it. And it's right. It's a horror film. It is a straight up horror film.
About an entomologist. How did you not see this earlier? You're an entomology person.
No, I saw this in college, I hadn't seen it recently. And then when I saw this article a couple of days ago that was talking about it as being a horror film, I was like, wait, I don't remember that. I need to rewatch. So the whole setup of this is that an entomologist is at this beach, this like rural desolate beach with just these miles upon miles of sand dunes. And he's collecting bugs. And he gets there and he gets really wrapped up in his work, and he gets late. And the villagers, like all of these local villagers, are like, oh, well, you can't leave now. You'll die. You should stay overnight. And he's like, cool, where can I stay? And they lead him to this house, this woman who lives down inside one of the dunes. And the only way to get down there is this rope ladder. And so he climbs down and he goes inside and he meets this woman whose husband and daughter died in a sandstorm many years ago. And she lives there by herself, and she fills sandbags for the villagers above who make them into concrete for their houses. And all of a sudden, the rope ladder disappears. And this guy realizes that the villagers have trapped him down there to be with her and make her happy and help her fill sandbags. And so he's trapped there. And so he begins this kind of searching for different ways to get out, trying to figure out how to get out. But at the same time, he's like realizing his own fate, that he is trapped there. The whole thing is shot like a horror film. There's so many scenes of like close-ups of eyeballs and screams, and it feels like an A24 film because it's everything is going on, but nothing is going on. And it's all of this existential dread just constantly crushing you, with this captivity of these villagers who are refusing to let this guy lead. Afterwards, I was like, there are so many notes of this that I see in something like Lighthouse, the idea of being trapped, like less mermaid vagina and more like aggressive sandy sex, but still it's got kind of the same notes to it.
Aggressive sandy sex is its own horror movie.
A lot of aggressive sandy sex, but it is just kind of this repetitive nightmare of him being trapped in this very kind of surrealistic world. It's got tones of like Eraserhead, I would compare it to, and things like that. This ended up getting nominated for a couple Academy Awards, which may be why it never got classified as a horror film, because rewatching it in that, it totally feels like horror films of the same time period, like Page of Madness, Qui-Gon, Horrors of Malformed Men, Onibaba. This is all the same time period, and it feels like those, but just never got classified as that.
It's also got a bit of a Harold Pinter vibe to like trapping the people, but it's a director, it's Hiroshi Teshigahara, and he's like, top five director for me. Made another one called Face of Another, which is equally nightmarish. There's a famous Japanese novelist called Kobo Abe, who is huge. He adapted like five of his novels, so they're all good. But then he became a flower expert, which in Japan is Ikebana, and he like became the Ikebana guy of Japan. Like, he's famous now for being the floral arrangement guy, and I'm like, wow. But he had this huge,
what an interesting career.
Oh, I love that shit. Really? I love that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's so weird, but he's really good. Like, and I agree, it's definitely a horror. It's like a lot of those, it's like Polanski, a lot of those directors, it's that kind of a horror film. It's mm-hmm. it's dread, yeah. And but it's beautiful.
It's
too.
All dread. It's all and dread. Sex. Yeah, dread gorgeous and dread and sex the whole time. So yeah, but that is Woman in the Dunes from 1964, which did get 5 stars.
I would be giving it 5 too.
Yeah, but anybody else before we go to our Night Flight pick of the week? Okay.
Ryan's going to sing us in. So, Night Flight pick of the week. That was Ryan. Thanks, Ryan.
I put myself on mute because I was having a coughing fit for a second, and then I was supposed to sing.
You're singing.
Do you have COVID? Is it allergies?
No.
It's allergies.
I don't have the Rona.
It's the Rona. Yeah. So our Night Flight pick of the week is, I love this film so much, and I know Rob does too. I don't think I've heard Elric talk about it. And this
I was the one who suggested it yesterday.
No, Elric loves it.
Oh, we're okay.
Yeah, it's great.
Amsterdam. Okay, guys, talk about it.
Dick Moss.
Talk about it. I believe the angle was convince Ryan that he needs to see it, because I've actually never seen this.
Ryan,
this is the most you movie. This is more you than us.
Come on. All right, Ryan. You guys are doing a so-so job of telling me.
Oh, let me just do it. I can do it in one sentence. On. Ready? It's a slasher.
Do it one sentence.
Boom. Out. I'm done. I'm sold.
I need more. Clearly.
Ryan, it's a scuba diver. It's a scuba diver slasher in the streets who uses the canals of Amsterdam to kill people. And it's directed by a guy named Dick Mass. This is the craziest movie I've ever seen. You'll love it.
Sold.
Greatest boat kill in the history of cinema. The greatest boat kill. Like, the first 20 minutes of the movie have the greatest kill ever.
It has a group of people on tour and a little kid in the tour boat going through the canal as a bloodied body just hits the front and just so. And I think it puts blood all over all of them, including little kid. I can't remember, but either way, I was like, I'll watch whatever this is.
So this is obviously early Dick Moss after the Lift and
is it after the
and before
yeah, before the Lift
Sint?
Before is it before or after the Lift?
I would have thought before, but it has some of the craziest stunts. Like, it has a lot of stunt work, a lot of crazy boat work. Yeah.
88. So I think it's after the Lift. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it reminded me of Night School.
But like, again, it's like a scuba diving guy who like just slips in and out of the canals to kill people.
Totally.
And then there's like an incredible boat chase in the third act. Like, basically, like, one of those, the most amazing stunts in this boat chase for the cop going after him. It's really solid.
Yeah, and Vic Armstrong, I just read Vic Armstrong, the legendary stunt guy, did all the stunts on this. So,
it's totally your movie. Like, for sure. That's kind of why I wanted us to pick it, because I feel like you're going to have a blast.
Yeah, this one, it's so shocking you have not seen this yet, Ryan.
Also, one of my favorite titles of all time, Amsterdam. How good is that?
So and there aren't a lot of films from that part of the world.
I was going to say, you say that just as I was about to tell you that Dick Moss's latest, which is a monster tiger movie called, I think it's called Uncaged, just hit iTunes last week.
Okay.
But the cover art is basically a town, but looming over this small city is a giant, like, lion monster.
A monster tiger.
I got about I got about 30 seconds into the trailer, to be honest, because it felt a little too tongue in cheek, and plus the dubbing was horrible. So I just kind of backed out. I'll wait for somebody like Shudder to put it on with subtitles or something, mm-hmm. and I'll catch up to it then. But Dick Moss is still going strong, guys.
Well, definitely check out Amsterdam. This is now on Night Flight Plus, which is a streaming channel available on Roku, Apple TV, Amazon Fire TV, and online. It is the only place to watch original episodes of the iconic 80s cult series Night Flight, which we all love, as well as a huge collection of cult films, music documentaries, midnight movies, concert films, and more. Subscriptions are $4.99 a month or $39.99 a year for a limited time. Shockwaves listeners can save $10 on their annual membership with the promo code SHOCKWAVES, one word, which takes it down to just $2.50 a month. So check it out online, www.nightflightplus.com/shockwaves.
What the hell else are you going to do?
Amsterdam right now.
And you can also check out Screamed.
Can I ask you guys about another weird foreign boat film?
Yes,
sure.
So three years ago now, I went on vacation to Iceland, and I got this very remote cabin in the middle of nowhere, and when we got there, like, oh, let's check out the DVDs, and they had a bunch of American family films and one horror film called Whale Watch Massacre that was an Icelandic C-list horror movie, but it had Gunnar Hansen.
Oh yeah, I think it's Reykjavik. It's called something
Harpoon
else here in the
massacre
States.
Here
Harpoon.
Yeah, it's
massacre.
Called like Harpoon.
It was truly awful. I know we didn't even finish it, but it was such a, I was like, this feels like someone made a Mad Libs of horror movies. They're like, all right, Iceland, whales, Gunnar Hansen.
I'm butchering the name because it's regional, but it's Reykjavik Whale Watching Massacre. And I remember I had interviewed Gunnar around like just before he started making the movie, but I remember he was very proud of it because it was from like where he's from, apparently. So
interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of really amazing horror films that come out of Iceland, but this is not one of them.
I forgot what his like. There was an emotional connectivity to the movie that I remember him talking about. I could be completely wrong, but I've never seen it. So glad I don't need to, according to Mallory.
Yeah, I'll save you all a click on Whale Watch Massacre.
Excellent, guys. Well, we will be back after a word from our sponsor, and then we are going to be discussing our favorite monsters from non-Universal films. Did I get that right? Yeah.
For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers around the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabre, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Their latest arrivals include from Arrow Video, the complete Gamera collection, and Beyond the Door, from Cauldron Films, Abracadabra, and American Rickshaw, and from Scream Factory, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. Whether you're looking for a definitive version of Suspiria, or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com. That's DiabolikDVD.com. It's a little crazy out there right now, so Fangoria is offering a free 2-month digital membership to everyone. Go to Fangoria.com for more information and to make an account. Then pour over all the exclusive articles, interviews, and reviews on the site, as well as original video content and podcasts. You'll even have access to high-resolution scans of the first 15 issues and original run of Fangoria magazine and counting. Go to Fangoria.com now to start your free digital membership. And if you're looking to add to your social distancing watch list, Fangoria's latest movie, VFW, is now available to stream on demand, and Satanic Panic is streaming on Shudder right now. And don't forget, our good friends over at Fright Rags have the official Shockwaves t-shirt, both the classic design from Cavity Colors originally and the new design that has our faces on it that you can touch all you want from a very safe distance.
Welcome back to Shockwaves, everybody. We're with our guest, Mallory Amiri. And can you, so just so we tie in why you're actually with us, other than that we call you every time there's a crisis.
I mean,
you did write a book. You wrote a book that came out last year, but the paperback edition is coming out now. So we were basically trying to tie this into your paperback edition of The Lady from the Black Lagoon. Is that the full title? Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay. There we go. So I don't think we've had you on the show to talk about it specifically, but obviously we are all children of monsters. We all grew up on Universal. I think Universal Monsters are kind of all of our introductory period to monsters. It's the first images I can remember as a little kid. So was the creature your first monster that led to this obsession?
He actually wasn't, although weirdly enough, and I do talk. So the book is a biography about Millicent Patrick, who's the one who designed Creature from the Black Lagoon. But my introduction to horror and monsters was another monster that she worked on, and I didn't even realize that until I started working on the book. But it was Chernabog from Fantasia.
Oh, wow.
I am a huge Fantasia fan, and I was kind of raised by my grandfather, and it's such a great grandparents movie when you're a kid. My grandfather had put it on, and it's a fun movie. I was probably 3 or 4, maybe 5, and it's fun, you know, dancing. Hippopotamus is awesome, great. And I thought it was, because when you're at that age, I feel like you're sort of like an art goldfish where you're, everything you kind of take in, you just sort of forget immediately. But as the film progressed and it got to the Night on Bald Mountain sequence, it was the first time where I thought, oh. And it was the first time I really thought about art after I had consumed it, because I thought about Chernabog and I thought about that sequence afterwards, and it really terrified me. But at the same time, I was so fascinated and I was so intrigued. And it was the first time that I really thought about a film and thought about the way that art can affect the viewer afterwards. And I just fell in love with that monster, and I kept I'm still chasing that feeling, you know. Years and years later, decades later, and I just wanted that feeling of seeing a film and being taken out of your reality, being afraid, but also whenever we see a monster, we want to know more. We want to know the story behind it. We want to know everything about them. And that was where the seed of it really was for me.
Nice. Oh my gosh. Fantasia messed me up so much when I was a kid. And now seeing my kids, like Disney, when they close Disney at night, they do this massive water show. Is it called Fantasmic? Yeah, I think it's called Fantasmic. They do this massive show at the end of the night at Disney where they spray water up from the area in front of the Haunted Mansion, and they do all these shows where they have characters come out and they'll broadcast stuff on the spray of water. It's really cool. And at Halloween time, they did a full like Night on Bald Mountain thing with Chernabog. And watching my eyes like peel back when this giant like 80-foot like 4-story Chernabog just comes out of the water, just it melted their brains, and it was so beautiful.
I remember being really disappointed because the sequence that follows that, the final sequence in the movie is, you know, when the church people are bringing candles and they're walking through the woods and he gets sort of banished into the mountain. And I remember as a little kid, I was like, wait, no, why are all these choir people banishing this cool monster? I want him to come out. I was so sad.
I liked the ghost horses. I remember thinking that that's cool. Like ghost horses. That's just awesome.
The whole sequence is incredible. And I don't know if you folks know this, but one of the people who was used as reference for Chernabog was Bela Lugosi.
Oh, wow. Dang.
I did not know
that. Makes sense. Wow.
And when you look at his hand movements, you can kind of see it. Oh. You're like, oh yeah, that's absolutely fucking Bela Lugosi. Wow.
That's awesome.
Cool. How did you first come across Millicent? Because I remember Creature was my favorite, like definitely my favorite design, my favorite creature growing up. And it was only about 8 years ago or maybe 10 that I first stumbled across that, like factoid, seeing that one picture of her designing it and being like, and then seeing her name. It was such an interesting name. And it was just like my brain just started worrying about it, and I didn't sit down and write a book about it. So how did that journey go for you?
Well, for me, I'm the really only person in my family who likes horror. I'm sure one of you and probably many of your listeners have had this experience where I didn't have an older sibling or anyone to show me the way. And I just sort of had to teach myself. So I thought, all right, well, the Universal Monsters, they're the classics. They're the way you have to start. And I went through all of them and I started at the earliest and I got up to Creature. And I think we'll all agree that Creature is really the last installment of the classic Universal Monsters. And like I did with all of them after I watched it, I fell in love with it. I fell in love with Creature. I thought he was one of the most empathetic of the whole group. I just, because I felt like him, you know, I was an awkward kid. I was clammy and weird, and I felt for Creature when he's swimming underneath Julie Adams. Like, that's how I felt when I was in the hallways at school, you know, looking at hot people. I really felt for Creature. And so I looked up online because I wanted to know trivia. I wanted to find behind the scenes photos. I wanted to know how I think horror is such a unique genre in that it really invites people to go behind the scenes. I think that's why I love shitty horror movies. I love seeing a zipper because you want to know more. You want to know how it's made. And horror is so unique in the way that you really want to find out how they did all these things. Like, I don't think there's few other genres of film that invite that. So I was, you know, looking up photos, and while I was in just like a Google image search, I found a photo of Millicent. It said Millicent Patrick, designer and illustrator. And it was like being struck by lightning. Because at that point, all my heroes were Jack Pierce, Dick Smith, Tom Savini, Rick Baker, it never occurred to me that women did that stuff. I didn't even think it was a possibility. I was really happy being a fan. I didn't think I could do that. And all of a sudden I was like, wait, what? Girls do this shit? And it totally blew my brain open. And she became my hero. The problem was there wasn't any more information about her. So she just sort of stayed this like mysterious hero for years and years and years.
Mm. And wow. When does you start going deeper though? Like, how do you find that first? Because there are people I'll look up and there's just other, even people like William Girdler, where they'll just be, who, you know, seems like somebody, there's lots of stuff. You look it up and there just isn't that much about some people. I'm sure if you could find people alive, you know, who knew them, obviously that's the first point of contact. But how did you make that leap from, oh, that I'm curious about that, to actually finding the first tidbit that could actually open up and be a full story?
Well, if you cut to about a decade later, Millicent really was part of the reason why I ended up becoming a professional filmmaker. I don't actually work in the film industry right now. Because of this book, I've concentrated on writing full time. But she helped show me the way and showed me that I could do it. And I ended up becoming a producer for an indie film company. And I got a tattoo of her on my arm.
Oh, nice.
Really cool.
Listeners won't realize, but we're all on a Zoom call and we can all kind of see each other. Yeah. And I got this tattoo of her. And then a couple of weeks later, I was at a party. I was living in Brooklyn at the time. And a literary agent that I was friendly with said, oh my God, you know, you got this tattoo of this woman. Like, who is she? And I said, well, I don't really know. All I know is that she designed Creature from the Black Lagoon. And he was like, wow, that'd make a great book. And I laughed. I was like, oh yeah. And he was like, Mallory, that would make a great book. And I was like, I'm not a writer. Like, I'm a screenwriter. I'm a filmmaker. But I sat and thought about it for a few days and I thought, man, I really want to know what happened to her. I was so desperate to know because she had been this beacon for me for years and years and years. And she didn't even have a Wikipedia entry. Like, nobody knew anything about Millicent Patrick. Wow. Didn't have a website. Like, just, she was just, no one even knew if she was alive. No information about her. And I thought, you know, fuck it, I'll try. And I had the contacts, you know, I know tons of people. And as listeners know, the horror industry is very small and we all know each other, or we know someone who knows somebody. And I thought, I'm going to give it a shot. And I spent 3 years and all of my savings in privately investigating her. And I found everything.
Oh. Now, yeah. I know from listening to your Penning Terror episode that you're like a research nut like I am. Like, where did you start? Like, did you go microfish? Did you go, you know, like people she knew? What was kind of your starting point?
My starting point was actually nerds. I knew so many other filmmakers and film historians that I thought, you know what? Because the only thing that anybody really knew for sure about Millicent Patrick was she worked on Creature from the Black Lagoon. So I thought, okay, that's going to be my sticking point. Let's start there. And so I reached out to tons of filmmakers and historians. A really good friend of mine, David Scow, who is a writer, also a noted creature enthusiast. That's why the two of us became really good friends. And I wanted to, I started reaching out to people and I said, all right, well, what do you know? And David Scow had a little bit of information on her. He knew some other people that might have some other information. And I just went from there, and people giving me email addresses. I ran into a lot of dead ends, but people started giving me rounding things out. It was actually Tom Weaver, who is a historian who wrote the book Creature Chronicles, which is a great book for people who are creature fans. It's a great overview of the creation of all three creature movies. And I emailed him and he was like, yeah, I'll give you what I have. But if you want, you can just go to the USC Cinematic Archives yourself. And I thought, oh shit. Cause I had never written a book before. I've never even graduated high school. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. And he's like, you could just go there yourself. And I thought, oh fuck. All right. And I emailed them and they were really helpful. I'm still actually very friendly with Ned Comstock, who is one of the head archivists over at USC, the Cinematic Arts Library. I don't know if any of you know him. He's a wonderful guy. But it was 3 years of that. It was like one person giving me the next clue to another thing. And I ended up finally making a big breakthrough, which I won't spoil because it's a big moment in the book, but it was just nerds.
And is that big moment what made you know it could be a book? Because this strikes me as saying that there's a good chance when you're doing this that it's just a Wikipedia page, right? Like that all you get is like, oh, there's not much there. Like even Betty Page, right, disappeared into suburbia land and just became who knows, right? So was that the turning point for you?
Yes. Up until that point, again, I won't spoil it, but it was meeting somebody very, very important. Not Millicent. I'm sorry. Millicent Patrick is dead. But meeting somebody and them, because up until that point, I had an idea of her career, a pretty good overview of what she did, except for the Disney stuff, which I actually ended up meeting another person who I'm friends with now, who was a Disney historian that helped me a lot. But meeting this person filled in who she was as a person and as a daughter and as a friend and as a family member and filled in all those other things. Up until that point, it would have made a really great article in like Fangoria, but it wouldn't have been a great biography. Mm-hmm. And finding that cracked everything open. But I was only able to get to that point through a series of libraries and archives and historians and lots of digging. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think something that's very unique to the narrative of your book and what I loved about it was, and it's probably when you got that turning point twist, right, that you decided to do this, is it's not a traditional biography by any means. It actually mirrors your own experience trying to find her and kind of what you went through in the industry, you know, trying to produce films and do stuff. And like the way that it literally mirrors a lot of her life. I mean, that couldn't have been the initial. Was it when you were investigating her that you realized, holy shit, I have so much in common with her experience? Because she had some really crazy twists and turns in her life. When did that become
Millicent Patrick, the Forrest Gump of the 1950s, because she had her, as I was discovering things, I was like, this can't be real. Like, she just had the craziest life. When I started writing this book, it really was supposed to be a straight biography. And to prepare for it, I was reading a lot of other biographies. And I actually listened to the audiobook of this biography called A Rather Haunted Life by Ruth Franklin, which is the biography of Shirley Jackson, who is the other queen of my world.
Oh my God.
It was an 18 and a half hour long audiobook. And by the end of it, you know what kind of sandwiches Shirley Jackson likes. And you know what kind of socks she wore. And I was like, this is great. But the only reason I give a shit about this is because I'm obsessed with Shirley Jackson. I can't write a book like this because nobody knows who Millicent Patrick is. I have to give them a reason to care about her. So I started writing it in that way because it was supposed to be just the beginning, because I wanted people to care about her because I care about her, and I wanted to show people why I care about her. And also, the reason why people don't know who Millicent Patrick was is Millicent Patrick had a lot of struggles with sexism, and it ultimately stole her career from her. And that stuff is still happening right now. you know, it's not a dead, it's not, it's so easy to be like, oh no, it's from the 1950s. Like that stuff happened, but it's not like it's stuff that's still happening today. And it's stuff. And I know because me and every other woman in the film industry that I know has had to deal with it.
Preach. So
the easiest way I knew how to do that would be like, okay, cool. Well, here's something that happened to me like 6 months ago. And finally, I realized that what better way to show how her career was purposely buried than to show how difficult it was to unearth it, you know? So I kind of wanted to bring people on that journey and to show, you know, what, you know, the consequences of this stuff was. Like Millicent Patrick's career was ruined from one shitty guy who made a bad, horrible decision. And I wanted to show people what the consequences were for the 60 years after that. And so many people were robbed of this, of knowing about Millicent Patrick and having her as a hero and knowing all the great things that she did. So it kind of turned into what it is now. And I always describe the book as Julie and Julia, but for monsters.
It's a good way to think of it. Yeah,
that's what it is. And so I am definitely a part of it. It was very hard to sell the book because of that. There was a lot of people who thought, you know what, I just want it to be a straight biography. But it was my literary agent who was like, no, I think this is the way to tell the story, to get people to care about her. And I like to think that he was right.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, like once you were doing the book tours and once you were going out there with the book, I mean, did you see, how many people did you see respond to that approach? I mean, like, you know, your book agent's clearly, you know, agreeing with you, and you think, you feel in your heart it's the right way to go. How many people out there got it?
A lot, actually. I was very nervous because I think this might be one of the first books that ever got hate mail before it came out. Oh, wow. All five of us are very acutely aware of like the dark side of horror fandom and like the trolls and the people who are, you know, every fandom has its, you know, troll community. And there are a lot of people who refuse to believe that Millicent Patrick worked on Creature because she's a woman, you know, people who I had a story straight out tell me that, you know, she probably was just somebody's girlfriend and that's why she was on, you know, around. So there was a lot of people who were in that camp, but when the book came out, you know, for 6 months before the book came out, I would wake up every day with sick to my stomach thinking, I'm going to get murdered. Like, everyone's going to hate this book. But the opposite happened. It was sort of like a Mad Max Fury Road thing where so many people saw the misogynistic reviews of it that other people wanted to read it, even if they weren't into horror. Every event that I do, I get a lot of horror people and a lot of women specifically who are into monster movies and like, were felt very seen by the book, but I also get an equal amount of people who are like, I have never seen a horror movie in my life. I never saw Creature before I read this book, but because of the way you wrote it, it felt very accessible to me and I love it. And now I'm going to watch Creature. I'm going to try to give it a shot. So I think my agent was right. And I think I did the right thing. And I'm very pleased with the way that it came out.
That's awesome. Yeah. Now, before we jump into our own favorite monsters, I'm really excited about the book that you're writing now.
I think
I told you already, my grandmother moonshined. So I grew up with her stills. And like when she died, we had to take down her stills. I remember that vividly as having to like take apart her stills when she passed away. So with that, what's the topic for your new book?
So the next book that I'm writing, which has already been sold, it's going to come out next year. It is the same team that did Lady from the Black Lagoon. It's called Girly Drinks, and it is the history of women drinking. It's much easier to write because there is no memoir element to it. I'm a little nervous because it's the first time in my career I've ever kind of jumped past the horror world. But it is from the time when alcohol was invented/discovered until now, all over the world, the history of women drinking and making booze. And it is so much fun to write. I am very sad because I had all these trips planned all around the country and around the world. I can't even go to the library now. So it's been pretty tough to keep working on it in quarantine, but it is an absolute fucking blast. I will say I do have another biography planned for another woman that was very intimately involved with the creation of another very famous monster, a monster that actually I think is probably more famous than Creature. But that is going to be after, farther down the line of books.
Interesting. Nice.
Nice. Wow. Yeah.
So I'm coming excited back to the horror world. You can't keep me away.
I'm excited about Girly Drinks though. though.
It's such a blast. It is so much fun.
Did you encounter a lot of female bootleggers? This has nothing to do with horror, but I always thought my grandmother was like an oddity. But then once I started actually researching it, it was like a common thing to have female bootleggers.
No, and that's what's funny is the book is actually longer than I intended it to be because I didn't realize how much history there was. From the dawn of when alcohol was invented, it's been women who were the ones who made it, women who were the ones who served it, women the ones who drank it. In the very beginning, the very first artistic depiction of anyone drinking was of a woman. The very first deity that had anything to do with alcohol was a woman. In the beginning, it was women who were the ones who were only allowed to make the beer. It was like, it was like a female centric thing. The first person who ever wrote about hops being added to beer was a woman, was a nun.
Wow.
You know, it's such a female centric thing. So next time you see some guy in a flannel shirt and a beard at a bar talking about IPAs, you know, you just remember that shit started as like women's work.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. I'm psyched. But we had some homework today, guys. So
I'm very excited about this.
The homework for the day was to pick your three favorite non-universal monsters.
And I think initially, I mean, I'm very curious to see where this all went. I initially pitched it as within that kind of era, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, so on.
Nope.
Yeah, I knew everybody would golf book, so I need to be very specific.
Two of my three are actually from that era.
Mallory, thank you. But yeah, I went pure. Yeah, I mean, like, because we were discussing the Universal Monsters from a specific era, that was kind of the approach. But yeah, it was, you know, whenever you talk about movie monsters, everybody kind of leans back onto the, you know, the famous Universal repertory company. So, you know, the challenge is what monster design or monster do you admire that is not part of that legacy?
Well, Rye, since you went classic, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I kind of went strangely in chronological order, which is weird. So I'm going to start with 1956, Forbidden Planet. And it's not Robbie the Robot. It is the Id Monster, which was predominantly, I mean, yeah. Well, first off, they showed Forbidden Planet a lot in my elementary school during those, like, like around the holidays when you just tell, like, the teachers were just like, fuck off. We're just going to roll the AV card in here and just put a movie on for the kids. Forbidden Planet was one of them. And, you know, in addition to being a sci-fi classic, it introduced us to an invisible monstrosity that you only saw when they electrified it. And when they electrified it, it became this kind of weird animated thing. And you always saw a glimpse of it. And it had like very lion-like features. But then the beauty of Forbidden Planet is you also see it's like footprint. And it's like this kind of claw. So your mind is automatically going, okay, giant claw, that's fucked up. Maybe it's got two, maybe it's got three, I don't know. But then when they electrify it and you start to see it manifest as this kind of animated thing, it's terrifying. It's really, really cool. And as a kid, it always scared the shit out of me. Now, since there have been, like, you know, different interpretations and different model kits and stuff like that that have been released out there of the monster based on either concept art or whatever. But I always thought it was cool because it was just like this two-legged thing that looked like a nasty lion. And based on, you know, what happens in Forbidden Planet, it really fucks you up. So, yeah, that always stuck with me. And I just always loved this monster from the id that always just like it just played with your imagination.
Okay.
Nice. Excellent. Rob, you got one for us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably going to do obvious choices for all of this. But in terms of non-universal monsters, I have to go back to the original Alien, H.R. Geiger. It is not even the sequels. The sequels don't get it right. It's the fact that it's got this translucent head that you could see kind of a human skull underneath. Like, they've never done that look again in any of the sequels. I mean, Stan Winston did a great job in the second one, but just that one. I mean, I think it's one of the most striking movie monsters of all time. Very little screen time in that first movie. And also even the guy that played him, I'm going to butcher his name. It was Balaja Badego, who was very giant Nigerian actor, very, very thin. And so he was in that costume wearing the head, and he died very young too. It was right after the movie. He died at 39 of sickle cell anemia. But you see, I just don't know if there's – You know it as soon as you see it, that weird design, and it's kind of funny. I always felt like Geiger was always trying to chase that dragon. There was always like, I guess it was just part of his style, but you would always see other iterations of Alien in his other artwork, whether it be Species or Danzig, How the Gods Kill 3. It's always interesting how he was always kind of going back to that key design. But I mean, you don't get much better than that original Alien in terms of monsters.
What?
You,
all right, you got one?
I'm seeing a circle, but I don't know if you guys see me in the same configuration. So I thought, oh, we're going in a circle.
No. Okay.
It's all just random.
Right now I have Ryan's on the bottom, and then Rob and Elric, and then me and Rebecca.
Okay, so there's no rhyme.
Yeah, I've been going across in the order that you are on my screen.
Random. I have a lot of contemporary ones that I really like and ones that I grew up on. But the first one that, like, my Kinder trauma moment, and I looked at it again, and I just think it's a beautiful design, is Medusa in Clash of the Titans, 1981.
Oh, great.
I saw that at, like, 5 or 6, and I still think about that image and the way the eyes glow. I think that was the addition that I wasn't aware of from reading books. And
why has no one done a great Medusa movie?
Written it down many times going Medusa movie. And then Dick, my friend, gave me, I haven't watched it yet, he gave me a Greek horror film from, I don't know, the mid-80s, and it's called Medusa. I haven't watched it yet. I don't know if Medusa's in it or not, but I have a film sitting on my shelf called Medusa, so I'm hopeful. But no, there's something about her power is also fascinating, being able to freeze people, but when the snakes come to life. And then you have that great quality when you're looking at something, you know, that isn't quite human, like Harryhausen's kind of animation, it also gives it another effect that's even more effective when you're a kid. Like, it's a whole, you're just not used to that as a kid. And it stayed with me. It's weird. Frankenstein was still the first, the image I can most conjure being little and seeing that first Frankenstein monster. But this would be very hot on its heels for me as Medusa.
Oh, yeah. Even the Medusa in Clash of the Titans, I remember.
Well, that's the one,
like,
I'm talking about. The 81 one.
Oh, no. Sorry. Jason and the Argonauts.
Right.
There's
a
Medusa and
both,
Jason
and
the Argonauts as well. My bad. But in that, like, you don't see her face until you see it in the reflection of his shield, I remember. And it is so horrifying. It's like burnt up and just awful. And then you see the decapitated head.
Yeah.
It's just
seeing
fantastic.
And I think that's the other part. If you're a kid, it doesn't matter if the thing was a villain or not. When its head is no longer attached to its body and someone's holding it up, that throws you, you know, as a kid. Yeah. I think that's a pretty disturbing image, but it's a really cool movie. I forgot that it was Harry Hamlin who's the star of that. I just totally forgot.
Oh, man.
So if you watch the clips now, it's kind of all, like, it's like, what? It's Harry Hamlin cutting the head off?
Yeah.
It's so weird. From L.A. Law? I was like, all right.
So good.
So, Mallory, you got one.
So I have two very obvious ones, but I will start with my more obscure one. So I am a huge werewolf fan. That is my favorite type of monster. The way that I chose all three of mine, where it's like, okay, what is a monster that I will watch any movie if it's in? And werewolf is definitely one of them. Unfortunately, I feel a lot of my favorite werewolf movies are directly disproportionate with how much I like the werewolf design. Like, I'm crazy about Curse of the Werewolf with Oliver Reed.
Yeah.
I hate that werewolf design. He just looks like he's made out of dryer lint. Like, I truly do not like that design. But Oliver Reed is incredible, and that film is incredible. A design that I do really like that is a more modern film, and I love the movie, and I love the character that this werewolf is When Animals Dream, which is a 2014 Danish.
So good.
Right? It's a Danish horror film,
beautiful.
And it is like a lady werewolf movie of my dreams, and I love the design of it. I love the character. I just love that whole movie. It's on Shudder right now if anyone wants to watch it. It's only like an hour and 20 minutes. It's a really good, quick film.
It got no love when it came out. Like, so little attention. It's so damn good.
So I use any opportunity that I get to talk about this film and how much I love it. And I love the design. I love everything about it. She's definitely that character. The character's name is Murray, is probably my favorite modern werewolf. Cause I'm a bipedal werewolf person, and like American Werewolf in London for me is one of like the standards for werewolf movies, but I don't like a quadruped werewolf. I want my werewolf to stand up like a human. She's just perfect.
Yeah. For mine, it's a far stray from werewolves. I'm going to 1968 for the movie Green Slime.
Oh, nice.
I love the aliens in Green Slime so much. Not only is this the greatest opening song in cinematic history, greatest theme song ever. I could dance to it all day. I love these monsters so much. They were just so much fun. This is one that my mom showed me when I was a kid, because my mom's a huge sci-fi buff. She would never call herself a horror fan until later, but anything Star Trek, or like I remember watching Forbidden Planet really young, anything that was more science fiction, she would watch with gusto and always showed it to me. I remember seeing Alien really young because of that too, because she didn't qualify it as horror. Predator as well, it was science fiction. And then later she realized that, yeah, she was a horror fan. But I remember watching Green Slime. We had it on VHS when I was a kid, and watching it in repetition. And I just always love the monsters in it. There, the whole setup is that the space station blows up, or I think they may hit. It's like a meteoroid or an asteroid. And then there's some type of like viscous cells inside that construct themselves into these alien creatures. And the alien creatures can reproduce rapidly by their own spilt blood. So like if you kill one and the blood hits the ground, like 20 more will take his place. Amazing. And they eat radiation. So they're attracted to the radiation of the spaceship. And so, but they're just, they walk around, they're bipedal-ish, like they're supposed to be kind of bally tentacle monsters, like green tentacle monsters. But because it is very Japanese in design, by Kenji Fukasaku, they kind of walk in a very kind of almost Godzilla-ish manner, where it's kind of like the men in the monster suits, with all of these tentacles coming off. They have one big eye in the middle, and it's just one that I fell in love with. It was never scary to me as a kid, this movie. I don't even know if it's intended to be scary, because it's so fun. But yeah, I want to give these monsters a hug constantly. And this is one I've showed Marnie a bajillion times. She can sing the theme song now. We have jokes about it around the house. And yeah, I love Green Slime monsters. Excellent. Rye, you got another one.
Nice. We're a Forbidden Planet. It was 1956. This one's 1957. The Monster That Challenged the World, which is basically about the Salton, an earthquake taking place around the Salton Sea during, you guessed it, atomic testing. And basically,
this is when the Salton Sea was still pretty, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And there was a dam, and it was during this atomic testing that it dislodges basically these monstrous mollusks that come up out of the from the bottom of the ocean and start to wreak havoc on anybody who's near the shore. And they're basically giant fucking snails with big beady eyes, and they look like monstrous caterpillars. And you see them you see them crush with their pincers scuba divers. You see them attack a laboratory full of bunnies, and see them prey upon a little girl. And I've always, my dad was the one who raised me on classic movie monsters and films from the, the 20s on up. And he did right by that, by showing me all this stuff before I kind of eased into the contemporary horror, just to show me where it all had come from. And I would go to Chiller Theater, and I would build model kits and all that kind of fun stuff. And the Monster That Challenged the World was always laughed at. And anytime, like, I remember kind of hanging out with some of these sculptors, and I'm like, oh yeah, I really want that Monster to Challenge the World. But I always had just a sweet spot for this big goofy monster. And some of the effects are really, really silly. Like when you see the kind of puppet puppeted, you know, mollusk just like crushing a scuba diver. It's very clear that they threw like a styrofoam scuba diver in so a wetsuit and crushed it on camera. It's really silly, but yeah, it's filled with it's laden. The movie itself is incredibly dated and laden with the usual misogyny that you got from those kind of atomic monster movies. But you know, the kind of goofy, I'm a scientist and I'm not being listened to and the government sucks journey is a lot of fun. And it's one that I like to revisit. I don't know if Scream Factory actually did a re-release of that, but I hope that they put it out along with like the mole people and everything they've done.
What's funny is with a lot of those old horror sci-fi films, like they are terrible to women, but I do think that there is a direct line between those like female lady scientists, like those lady scientists in those, because there was always like one lady scientist who was like super hot and kind of like
who never did anything. Yeah, she would just show up and then he would be like, the doctor would come in and be like, step aside.
But I don't think we would have had characters like Dr. Stadler or Dana Scully or a lot. I think that there is a line there. Yeah. I think some ground was being laid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll never forget. I mean, like for every – there was a line in either Creature Walks Among Us or Revenge of the Creature where these – doofballs are like sitting in a rowboat and one of them is like, oh, I'd like to have a small cold beer, and the guy's like, or a warm hot blonde, and it was like, oh geez, you can hear the horns of like, burr, burr. But then, you know, so you're right, it was always followed by this woman, this fast talking scientist who would come in and buck the system and impress all the guys and come to the table with knowledge and savvy and intelligence. But you're absolutely right. I mean, like,
it was a time where women actually got to do things, which was interesting, even though they were like always the, you know, the slightly, like they were never as good as the other male scientists. They were scientists, like they got to do stuff. So I feel like that was definitely a step, even though it was always like, yeah, the hot blonde.
Yeah. But that's my second monster, is a monster that challenged the world.
Nice. Rob, what's your second?
So my second one actually ties into Alien in the sense that I actually felt, I felt similar seeing it for the first time. And that's actually Cloverfield and the Cloverfield monster. And I remember, you know, that was such a unique, I don't know if we'll ever see anything like that. Like Ryan and I were in the web game at that point, and I remember, first of all, they didn't even give us the title. They just had a kick-ass trailer. And you're like, what the hell movie is that? Like, I have to see that, whatever it is. And then they were super secretive. They didn't let you didn't see that creature until you were in the theaters. And I remember, you know, some of the sites, scoop, this is the Cloverfield monster, which wasn't at all. It was like a blurry close up of something, who knows. But you don't see it that much in the movie. It's a giant sort of, I don't know, spider squid like thing, I guess. But what I loved about it is the way that they showed in the movie. It reminded me of Alien in the sense that when you first saw Alien, you're like, what am I looking at? I can't even fully comprehend what that is. Like, is it a thing on two legs? Is like, what is it? And so I remember feeling that seeing Cloverfield, and I got to see an advanced screening of it in New York City. So it was, you know, this is post 9/11. So there was something really surreal about, you know, living in a post 9/11 world, seeing this creature destroy New York, and then walking on to 42nd Street, the street we just saw destroyed by this strange creature. And yeah, I was in that
screening too, Rob.
Oh wow,
yeah, I mean, that same screening,
and it was a great way to see it. It actually like shook me up quite a bit seeing it that way, and I'll never forget. I think they did a figure of it briefly that sold out right away, but. Yeah, I mean, that's the real thing that's missing from all these like Cloverfield tie-in movies, right? Is like, you never get a good creature in there. So that one, Alien and Cloverfield are pretty solid in my book.
I still stand at my favorite shot in Cloverfield is when they run into the convenience store and they look at the television and the TV is broadcasting coverage from a news chopper hovering over the city, and you just see this monster stumbling through the streets. But they gave it personality. Like, you know, the JJ gave it a sense, it grounded it in such a way that the monster looked incredibly confused, and it was like, why the fuck are all these buildings around it? Why am I getting shot at? And I immediately had empathy for it. I was like, I love this guy. Whatever he is, wherever he's from, I love him. He's gonna cause a big mess, but I forgive him like Godzilla.
And it's also, I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time, but the last time I revisited, it's one of the only found footage movies that literally does not break the rules of found footage. And what I mean by that is, like, you always have to stretch the narrative a little bit, right? But they're racing over an old tape of them as a couple, and the final shot is like the tape goes back to the previous thing, is them. I think like Coney Island or something, and you see the alien in the background freaking like drops into the water, and you're like, oh, there's the origin right there. Like literally the last shot is showing you just a couple of weeks ago when it first arrived or whatever it is. Yeah, I love that movie and I love that monster.
Yeah.
My next one is monsters plural. This is like when you fall in love with a world, and when you're a kid, I never wanted a sequel to a movie in my entire life more than I wanted one.
I know where you're going.
Nightbreed knocked my fucking socks off as a kid, and I've met adults like, you know, who weren't as into it. Maybe they didn't see it at the age I saw it at, and I don't know if I'd seen Hellraiser yet or not. I knew who Clive Barker was. I think I'd read some because of that quote that Stephen King wrote about him. But man, this movie just lit my brain on fire. And Pelequin, if I had to pick one, I think Ryan was just talking about the personality, you know, of monsters. Maybe it was Rob. They do such a good job of giving all these different monsters believable personality, character traits. They all have very little screen time when you think about it overall, because each one has to be introduced and then move to another monster. And again, you're on the side of the monsters in this movie. You go to Midian where the monsters are, and the real monster of the movie is Cronenberg's Decker character, which is another great design. So when he is in monster getup, it has a personality of its own. And just some of these creatures, I haven't rewatched it for a few years. I went to that not great screening where they did the Cabal cut, but it wasn't really done, and it was before the Blu-ray and all that.
I hosted that.
I love that. It kind of took something away from the movie for me because of all the unfinished work, and I haven't watched the Blu-ray version.
They were putting it together from an assembly cut they got off VHS.
Yeah.
It was an assembly work print that someone had found a VHS copy.
I'm in the minority
of.
That had so no problem rough. With the other version, so I don't like. I know, and it's not about Clive's vision, but just for me as a viewer, when I watched the first version of that movie, I loved it so much that I didn't need anything else. So I will watch the extended, you know, Blu-ray edition for sure. I'm curious, but yeah,
it's a miracle. It's a miracle.
Okay, so
they like restored it. It's not at all like it's a finished movie. It is a fully restored finished.
That's good to hear.
Director's cut of it. Yeah,
I think I've just been nervous because of that screening. But just my memories are so good. And there was even an Amiga. I had an Amiga at the time, and there was an Amiga video game of Nightbreed that came out briefly at that time, and I remember getting the box going, how does this exist? It was such an obscure, like, to me it was a major movie. It wasn't like a small movie that never had a sequel. I was just sitting in New Zealand waiting for the sequel because I assumed it was huge because it looks big. Like, as a kid, you don't think about box office. You think about, oh, the movie looked big, so I'm sure there's going to be a sequel, and the ending has the ultimate sequel cliffhanger ever in a movie where you're like, oh cool, when's the creepy preacher guy come back to torment everyone, you know? And where's Decker come back? So yeah, it's just I love these creatures. I just think it's such a great world, and each one is just so unique. Big fan.
Excellent. Mallory.
So my next one starts in the 50s, starts around this time period, but is still going. I have to say it's Godzilla. Classic, a favorite of many. I love God. It was really hard for me not to say Chernabog from Fantasia, but since I already talked about it in this podcast, I will talk about my love of Godzilla. I fell in love with him when he was a little kid. I love everything about him. I love kaiju films. There's so many good ones. I love it, and I love it as a genre, and I love Godzilla as a monster and a character because it's something that seems so straightforward. You know, it's just big monster, crushes stuff. Cool. But at the same time, Godzilla is such a nuanced, interesting, multi-layered character in a way that is always very surprising to me. You know, he has this very on again, off again relationship with humanity. In some movies, he's the villain. Some movies, he's helping, sort of depending on the film. And I kind of love that he's just this massive, especially depending on the film, how massive he is scale wise. But he's just this, and sometimes he's not a he. You know, in the original Toho films, Godzilla was, as we would say now, non-binary. Like Godzilla did not have a gender. You know, there's that films where Godzilla lays eggs, and so him being so nuanced and so complicated is so fascinating to me, because you think about it, he's just fucking Godzilla, you know.
Yeah.
But he's such a great metaphor, and he's so fun. I do, and when it comes to modern Godzilla movies, I have to vote for Shin Godzilla over, you know, the Godzilla films. The quality of them has varied so widely. But when it comes to monsters, again, I chose the monsters that I will always watch a movie with them in. And it doesn't matter what Godzilla movie it is. I mean, maybe Matthew Broderick one I would not turn on. But most Godzilla movies, if a Godzilla movie is on, I'm watching it.
Nice. So for mine's very left field, and it's not from a movie. So y'all can yell at me later for not following directions. But this one truly had a huge effect on me. This is Fluke Man from X-Files.
Yes.
nice.
So, yeah. Okay. It's acceptable. It's acceptable. Okay.
I almost picked something from a TV show, and now I'm mad that I didn't.
So, I had posted up. So the very first day we were under quarantine, I cleaned out my attic, and I started going through all these old pictures, and I found my senior yearbook picture, and then suddenly remembered that in my senior yearbook picture, I literally cosplayed as Dana Scully. Like, I bought the suit. I did my hair. I took a picture of her from Entertainment Weekly of her standing there with her arms crossed into the photographer and said, this is what I want to do. And they did it. And so I posted up on Instagram the side-by-side of like 16-year-old me cosplaying as Dana Scully. So yeah, so just massive torque in my high school yearbook photo. But at the same time, while I was looking at that picture and posting that up a couple of weeks ago, I was remembering how much X-Files had an impact on me in high school, and how seeing like this female character who was clearly the one in charge, like Mulder was there and was cool, but he was not the bright bulb of the box for me. Like, he was there and he was the believer and pushing the narrative forward, but it was Dana who was like the one solving the problems most of the time. And I loved that. And so I ended up rewatching the first two seasons just while I've been jogging during quarantine. I've been like throwing it on, and fell completely in love with Fluke Man, and remember how much I loved him to begin with, and how he was the one that I was like, I will never leave this. This series can never go wrong for me. I don't care how much we have to sit through weird cancer stories to get back to kind of the monster of the week that I love so much. So Fluke Man, his whole setup was that I think he was born on a Russian freighter. There was some type of like radiation, toxic waste story with him, where it was like some type of cells that he grew up with him. Somehow he ends up in Jersey, like you do, and washes into the Newark City sanitation.
I love this episode.
I know. And so he's now in Newark and starts taking people down. And the big thing is that he's not necessarily killing them. He bites them, and it leaves this like tapeworm-ish, like four hook incision on them. But when he bites them, his body is full of fluke worms or flatworms. They're just these really basic, usually innate worms. I remember doing experiments on them in science class in college where you could actually slice them in half and they'll regenerate the other half of their body. Pretty cool. But it's these little like flatworms, and he is infested with them. So when he would bite, he would insert their eggs into the bloodstreams of his victims. And so they didn't die from the bite, but they would die days later from toxic shock of being infected with all this bacteria and the flatworms. And I love that biology so much. The episode was so disgusting. It was just absolutely wonderful. When I looked it up, apparently there was a long-running joke that Chris Carter had where they would make any new writer on the show put on the suit. I don't know if that's true or not. It just seemed like an awesome rumor of like,
incredible.
Welcome to the show, put on the Fluke Man suit.
Incredible.
But yeah, I love him so much. And he makes appearances throughout the entire series. Like, he comes back in photographs. They make reference to him. There's discussions about him later on. But yeah, he was just always one of my absolutely favorite monsters and really kind of amplifies what I love about monsters is creating something completely original, something that you haven't seen before, something that seems to be grounded in biology, but something that we never see in our real life, but seems grounded in it. And I love that about him. So that's Fluke Man. So, okay, Rye.
My final pick is 1958's It, The Terror from Beyond Space. This is the 1950 sci-fi horror movie that kind of inspired Alien and Dan O'Bannon. And I know that there was at some point a lawsuit, I believe. I could be completely wrong. It's been a while since I tracked all of that. But it's basically about a space crew who are on another planet. They get back on their ship. They're heading back to the back to Earth, and they discover something has stowed away on their ship with them. The monster itself has just always had a soft spot in my heart. He kind of looks like a really pissed off pig with a perpetual frown and a tongue coming through his mouth. And I guess if I looked like that, I'd be pretty pissed off too. But, you know, he comes with scales, but I don't know what it is about this dumb fucking thing. It's clearly a man in suit. Sculpting wise, design wise, it's just like somebody just went, okay, let's give him a frown. Now put a bunch of teeth in it and then give him an upturned nose and a perpetual like frown and a furrowed brow, and then let's make him scaly. And for that, I love him. And the movie itself is actually pretty good because if I recall, it's been a while since I've watched it, but if I recall, it begins with the arrival of the spaceship and the lone astronaut on board being put on trial for murder because no one believes that there was an alien stowed away on the ship that killed the rest of his crew. So it's kind of a precursor to a lot of those scripts and movies that you see now where it begins with the cold open of something really terrifying happening. And it goes 3 weeks earlier and then you kind of get your story kick off there. But it The Terror from Beyond Space is my last pick.
Nice.
Very cool. For me, there's so many ways to go with this. It's like, I love the pumpkin head design. I love werewolves. I could go with that or whatever. But honestly, I love the critters. So the critters are my final choice. I think they're the perfect design. They're kind of meant to be in the wake of like Gremlins ripoff movies. Like you have like Gremlins and Ghoulies and all this stuff. But when I really think about it, I just love the idea of this perfectly round fuzzball that happens to have porcupine spikes that it spits at people. I love that they're vulgar and funny and actually curse all the time. They're cool, cute monsters. I love them. And they're kind of, I like the eyes too. It kind of reminds me of what, who was it? Joe Cornish did with Attack the Block later on. Yeah. They seem like giant critters to me, those creatures. they're great little monsters. I love them. I figured I'd wrap it up with a very fun one. And there's five movies and a web series. Like there's so much critters out there, but that first movie's really great. The first one's actually a legit fun B horror movie. So critters, that's my last pick.
You just reminded me of how similar they are to the Dark Crystal character Fizzgig, which little ball of fur, but it literally like unhinges and it's this massive jaw, but it's like a little ball of fur. It's cute, but it reminds me of critters now. So, Elric.
Yeah, Ghoulies, right? No, it's not cool. it just felt on point if you're doing critters. I also had Pumpkinhead shortlisted on here too, but it's so close to the alien design in a lot of ways. Like, but I love it. The difference with that one is I love seeing it in full body. The first alien, when you see it full body, it's not quite as good. Mm-hmm. But Pumpkinhead, when you see it full body in kind of the thunder lightning, oh man, he does such a good job lighting it. But I wanted to throw a little love on one, Dwight Renfield. I think Dracula is a hard thing to reinvent. Yeah. You have the Nosferatu.
I'm fucking wait!
This is a different one. Different Renfield. This is the Night Flyer vampire.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Because It's so hard to reinvent Dracula, and the other best design, I think the Salem's Lot vampire is amazing. I think I think there's lots of great versions. But when I watched this movie, and you know, again, it's not the easiest movie to see nowadays for whatever reason. And there's stuff with the Miguel Ferrer storyline that feels a little dated. But every time you see the Night Flyer on the screen and what he's doing, it hasn't dated a second. It's terrifying. He's got the slack jaw. So usually we think of romantic vampires. It's not a romantic vampire. His face is disgusting. It's saggy. It's like when it opens, it's more like the Predator.
It's got like one tooth sticking down, right?
And he's wearing like the weird trench coat thing. It just there's something about this character that I almost want to see another movie with him, like a sequel, but like let's see a whole nother story with that. I didn't look up the designer. Oh, well, I knew it's Nicotero Berger and Kurtzman. So I know it's KMB, but I don't know if somebody illustrated it prior to them. I don't know where the design or how much Stephen King had written it to look that way, but it stays with me, you know. The Salem's Lot vampire stays with me too, but this one is just so different. So if people haven't seen this one, I think they should check it out. He made my monster list way back when we did, what was it, like a Monster Squad episode?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He was on there. Mallory. So
it's tough. This was a tough list to make just because monsters are, that's my favorite genre of horror. That and like haunted house stories, but monsters are my thing. Although I have to be a basic bitch and choose another massive, super popular monster and say King Kong. I love an ape movie. When I was 7 years old, the film, do you guys remember the Buddy movie with Rene Russo?
Oh, as in like the buddy as in the dog or no?
No, Buddy was a big gorilla. Oh my God, it was Rene Russo and Robbie Coltrane and Alan Cumming. And I fell in love with it and I saw the remake of Mighty Joe Young and I just fell down the rabbit hole of big ape movies and then got to the OG King Kong and I just fell in love. I love King Kong. I'll watch any King Kong movie, even the ridiculous bad ones. I just love giant ape movies. Again, just like with Godzilla, and I, you know, it's there's a lot of things like, oh, you got to choose one or the other. It's impossible for me to choose between Godzilla and King Kong. I want them to be best friends and like hang out together instead of fighting each other, which I know they're going to do, and it's going to be great. But I just love big ape movies. The original King Kong is just still so good. The design of it is so. There's something magical about watching a movie like that of like knowing that history was being made when you're watching it and you're like, wow, this holds up, and you just are still transported back to when it came out. Like, oh my God, can you imagine like how absolutely magical this was? And there's just something that still has, there's so much magic in that movie that I have to go with the OG King Kong.
Yeah. That handmade quality is amazing to that film.
It's beautiful. Beautiful. So for my final one, I will say Deep Rising was, of course, on the short list. And I'm also, and this is kind of where it fell, I'm a huge fan of chimera monsters, where it's like taking a whole bunch of different creatures and pushing them together into one. So in that, the Cthoga definitely is up there. I know Ryan's from Relic. Ryan's a big fan of the Cthoga.
I do like that monster.
It's a fun monster. But that said, what I ended up going with as my favorite monster, because it combines my love of chimeras and aquatic horror, is The Host from 2013. Before he made Parasite, he made The Host. So let's remember that he came from a horror backing. And I mean, Parasite has its horror notes as well. But The Host, South Korean film, the whole setup is that American military has been dumping, I think it's formaldehyde, into their main river system. And so all of these different creatures start kind of merging together into this one massive frog, fishy, snake tentacle thing. That starts coming out and eating people. And it's a comedy, but it's got really sentimental moments. I cried when I first saw this because it's got all these family dynamics. And I just love this creature. Because again, it's just kind of the whole creation of a new thing, but it's using things that we already have, that it's grounding itself in. And I love the way that the creature moves. Like, I thought that this was just such a clever, a lot of times when you get these creatures, the whole idea of how it's moving through space or how it's functioning or how does it jump versus how does it swim. And this creature just was the fucking shit. Like, I love just how it moved across the board and how agile it was in every capacity. So I love The Host. I don't know if the creature has an actual name. I didn't look it up, but Yeah.
I think there's something magical about the host because, like we're talking about, there's so many monster movies where the human characters take a backseat to the monsters, and that's normally fine. But I think he does such an incredible job of making the characters in The Host really, that you care about them and you're invested in them.
Oh, God, yeah.
Such an ability to, he's almost like Stephen King in the way that, like, you get these everyday people, and all of a sudden you are so in for them and you're rooting for them so strongly, whereas most other monster movies, especially bigger monster movies, they're just like people that are going to get killed, you know?
And I love this movie so much because what should be the saddest moments in the movie are the most hilarious. Things like the funeral just absolutely hilarious, but yet the most simple moments, like when they're sitting alone just eating bowls of microwavable ramen, those are the ones where I want to cry. And that's really good directing and really good script writing all kind of combined together. This is just, I love this film. It ages.
And we'd be able to see it in movie theaters right now if Corona hadn't happened, because all of his films were coming back to the draft houses. Wow. You would have seen Memories of Murder. You would have seen all of them. It would have been so good, but we'll have to wait a little longer. So, that's our monsters.
But check out The Host. Yes.
Yay! So,
good exercise, guys.
And just to kind of cap with monsters, Underwater just came to Amazon Prime today, so that's I'm awesome. About to go watch it with my daughter. Yeah. So, yeah.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. So.
Very cool. Hey, happy birthday to Ernie, our secret silent partner who makes the show happen.
Happy birthday.
Especially remotely now. Thank you, Mallory, for coming on the show. People can get your book right now, The Lady from the Black Lagoon, anywhere that you buy books.
Yeah, it's out in paperback. It's out if you're a podcast person and like listening to things, I do narrate the audiobook, which is available everywhere.
Oh.
But bookstores are really hurting right now. So if you want to help both your local independent bookstore and the post office, you can order the paperback from your local indie and get it shipped to you and do your civic duty for a couple of things right now. But there are pictures in it. So if you are interested in seeing some unseen photos of her, of Melissa Patrick and her artwork, you can check that out. They're only available in the book.
If you're from LA, buy it from Larry Edmonds bookstore, because that store could go under, and it's been around for like 80 years. It's one of the three oldest shops in LA and Hollywood, up there with Musso and Frank's, and it's one of my favorite things in LA. And yesterday they posted that they will probably go out of business unless they can do this fundraising. So, and they've always had the best film books, like ever, in any store I've ever been to. So if you are able to, you know, support the things you love during this weird ass time, do it.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well,
excellent, guys.
Thank you. Stay safe. Thanks, Mallory, for joining us. And we'll see you all.
Thanks
next
for having
week.
Me on for the best episode. This is like the episode I was made
you
to
were.
Be on. I was very thrilled.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Well, thanks.
Hopefully, I will see you next time I talk to all of you together. It won't be some crisis. Sort of weird disaster.
Oh,
yeah.
No crisis.
Oh, it will be. It will be a crisis. You're.
Oh, no. We're going to be driving cross country. We're going to have a day and a half to do it. We're going to call Mallory. Yeah. We're going to be like, I don't know what it is, but we got to be in Topeka by Tuesday, and we're going.
I'm actually afraid next time we're all at a con or at a film festival, like some wacky thing is going to happen. Like, all right, well, we've all got a canoe back to Los Angeles together.
Tidal wave hits the middle of America, and there we go.
Something weird.
Excellent. Well, we will be back next week, guys. Have a good night.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Sanier, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Bassetta, and Rob Galuzzo.